You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is, ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter is a live show here at KPFA, and I'm delighted to be here live, unusual for me to drive down today. I'm also excited because I'm joined by Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks, Bonnie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good to have you on again. We're going to be hearing a lot from Tony about the new Guns and Butter website and other developments. I did want to take a moment before we go to the first cut of our incredible premium. We're bringing you Barbara Honecker on her research into the Pentagon on 9/11. Very, very good stuff. Very thorough. So anyway, we're real excited to be here to support KPFA, to support the fun drive on Guns and Butter, and we're hoping that you will too. We're bringing you first a 20-minute cut from an incredible 3-hour DVD, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't and Why It Matters, with Barbara Honecker. You know, Barbara Honecker has quite a history. She was part of the Reagan administration. She worked for Reagan's domestic policy advisor. Her office was right above the Oval Office. She was the first one from the Reagan administration to resign as a matter of conscience because of the treatment of women's rights. She went on to write October Surprise, which covered the Iran side of Iran-Contra, and then, of course, for many years, she's been a very dedicated 9/11 activist with a specialty in the Pentagon. So how about, let's play that first cut from Behind the Smoke Curtain.
The title of my talk is Behind the Smoke Curtain. The alternative title for my talk is Or Everything You Think You Probably Know About the Pentagon Attack Is Wrong. So, what happened at the Pentagon and didn't, and why it matters so terribly much for our future. 1 year before 9/11, on September 11th, the year 2000, the neocon organization that called themselves Project for a New American Century, or you may have heard the acronym PNAC or PNAC, actually called in one of their publications for a new Pearl Harbor. This famous quote is from the Project for New American Century Manifesto from page 51. Quote, "The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor." Unquote. As the Project for New American Century Manifesto was being published, this offer was made to producer Aaron Russo a full year before 9/11. In September of 2000, Nicholas Rockefeller, of the Rockefeller family who built the Twin Towers, told Russo, quote, "There's going to be an event, and out of that event, we're going to invade Afghanistan. So we can run pipelines through the Caspian Sea, so we can go into Iraq, so we can take the oil, so we can establish bases in the Middle East to make the Middle East part of the New World Order." And then he says, "In my relationships with some of these people, the Rockefellers, the Council on Foreign Relations, etc., in my relationships with some of these people, I can tell you that is as evil as it gets." That's Aaron Russo. If he joined them, Russo was told, he would, quote, "be spared the police state measures, the domestic surveillance state measures, that would be imposed on the rest of the American public," that means you, "after," quote, "the event," unquote, "happened." This is a year before 9/11. And you can see this statement by Aaron Russo on a video on the net. The Project for New American Century neocons prepared the ground for 9/11 so it would be seen as a surprise attack, which it wasn't, and for the chorus of Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, New Pearl Harbor on September 11th. In the months leading up to the 9/11 attacks, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld gave out literally hundreds, if not thousands, of copies of neocon Roberta Wohlstetter's 1962 book on Pearl Harbor, a book which pushed the false surprise attack and intelligence failures official line of the original Pearl Harbor attack. She was the wife of neocon godfather, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz's personal mentor, Richard Pearl's father-in-law, and Zionist passionate war hawk Albert Wohlstetter. The movie Pearl Harbor hit theaters in late May of 2001. Using real Navy ships that were arranged with the Navy by the Navy's man in Hollywood, who was on deck to assure so-called historical accuracy and pyrotechnic special effect. Only an attack on an iconic national military facility, however, could give them their new Pearl Harbor. Just think about it. Even though on 9/11 the World Trade Center attacks were more spectacular, for sure, and they were the first attacks of World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2, they would have been likely seen, in my opinion, as just a very much bigger World Trade Center 93 or a much bigger Oklahoma City. But both of those attacks had already been handled by the civilian courts, and these people did not want the 9/11 attacks to be viewed as a bigger Oklahoma City or a bigger World Trade Center 93. They wanted them to be viewed as a new Pearl Harbor, which required an attack on something like the iconic military facility at Pearl Harbor, and that iconic military facility was the Pentagon. Only the Pentagon attack made 9/11 into the new Pearl Harbor that the authors of the PNAC manifesto wanted and needed to roll out their global domination agenda. They needed it to claim justification for endless preemptive wars, which we are still in over 11 years later, for their global domination agenda. And most people don't know, point three, for the creation shortly after 9/11 of the first U.S. mainland combatant command. It's called NORTHCOM. And what that means is, if you recall, that the Bush-Cheney administration very much wanted and said that the entire world, meaning including the mainland United States, your homeland, was now part of the global battlefield. And in order to make it literally a battlefield, they had to, for the first time, create a combatant command over mainland United States called NORTHCOM. It also enabled the new Pearl Harbor attack on the Pentagon, in addition, of course, to the other attacks of 9/11, but it was the key one, is what I'm arguing, enabled the Bush-Cheney administration to bypass on 9/11 and before 9/11, there was joint authority over NORAD's response, over the jets that were so late in responding to all of the attacks on 9/11, took an hour and 15 minutes, which was absurd. On and before 9/11, the decisions as to NORAD responses were actually the joint authority of the U.S. President and the Canadian Prime Minister. So once NORTHCOM was created, they separated out the decision-making, the unilateral decision-making authority of the U.S. President over those kinds of responses. Also, of course, the 9/11, and in particular, the Pentagon made it into the new Pearl Harbor, justified, they claimed, their domestic surveillance state that we are still within. And they enabled Bush Jr., President George W. Bush, to continually evoke Article 2 of the Constitution, his so-called commander-in-chief powers, which he did and members of his administration did over and over, repeatedly, to justify violation of our Bill of Rights, of U.S. federal law, of international law, and even Nuremberg principles. Bush even said that it was the Pentagon attack that made it war in his mind and a new Pearl Harbor. in his memoir, which has been published, his book, and in his speeches after his memoir was published, he said that it was after the World Trade Center 1 hit, he thought it was due to it just being a terrible pilot. That is an accident. He said in print that when he was told of the second hit, presumably we are told when Andrew Card whispered in his ear, America's under attack, even then he didn't think we were at war. Not per se. He said in his memoirs and his speeches after his memoirs were published that it was with the Pentagon attack that he knew we were at war. And you had to be able to sell to the American public and the world that we were at war in order to justify all these horrendous actions in the name of the 9/11 lie. Bush wrote in his diary on September 11th, quote, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today," unquote. Because the Pentagon attack had, therefore, to succeed, to affect us being at war, to affect the new Pearl Harbor, and to get their global domination agenda and surveillance state, they couldn't rely upon mere hijackers, no matter who they were, even if there were any. They had to control the operation. And in order to control it, they had to execute it, and only pre-placed explosives, both at the World Trade Center, as David Ray Griffin and Richard Gage and Niels Harrit and Professor Stephen Jones and many others have proven, is the real story at the World Trade Center, both World Trade Center's Towers 1 and 2, with planes, plane approaches and impacts as the mere cover cause, so that it would be apparent that the buildings came down to the uninitiated because of the plane's impacts and the fires. The same, as you will see from this presentation, is true at the Pentagon, that the real story at the Pentagon is pre-placed inside the building explosives with a plane approach and destruction as the cover cause. To get their new Pearl Harbor, the Project for New American Century neocon signatories, in order to be certain that they had it, they had to steal the 2000 election. And they did that in Florida, where Bush's brother was governor, Jeb Bush. A Project for New American Century signatory. Bush v. Gore was argued by none other than Ted Olson, whose wife Barbara's, we now know, non-existent alleged cell phone calls from the alleged Pentagon plane Flight 77 were the source, the most important source for the claim that the alleged Pentagon plane hijacker story, that there were hijackers on that plane. And without that story, there is zero evidence that Flight 77 even returned east, even if it was Flight 77, as you'll see, that left Dulles Airport to begin with. And the entire official story of the Pentagon attack falls apart. And in case you question that the cell phone calls of Barbara Olson from Flight 77 have been deemed non-existent, that is now the official position of the FBI in the Massawi trial of the Pentagon and of American Airlines. Per David Ray Griffin. Bush planned on being a, quote, war president, unquote, before he even ran for the office of president. He said so. With Bush's election, the Project for New American Century signatories then became the U.S. government. You will see that in the next slide, which I will not be able to read because it goes on and on in fine print forever, of all the PNAC signatories and participants. There were two levels, signatories and participants, who actually became the United States government. Once in power, however, only the Pentagon attack guaranteed Bush and the Project for New American Century signatory and participants, Bush becoming a war president, and their getting their new Pearl Harbor to roll out their global domination and domestic surveillance state agenda. This will be in my book, all of this. But following the theft of the 2000 election, and by the way, Bush v. Gore was decided by the Supreme Court completely unconstitutionally, because the Constitution makes explicitly clear that in the case of a contested presidential election, that the House of Representatives makes the decision, not the Supreme Court. So following this after the 2000 election, the Project for New American Century Manifesto, signatories and participants literally became the U.S. government uniquely, with the motive, means, opportunity, and access to effect their new Pearl Harbor in the attacks of 9/11. And what you could can barely see here are, this is name after name after name of the individuals who were PNAC manifesto signatories and participants, and they're absolutely top positions in the federal government once the election was stolen. Only the Pentagon attack enabled We Are at War, which you notice this is from immediately after 9/11. This is the National Security Agency, NSA, General Zahner, who was the head of their Signals Intelligence Directorate. And they apparently expected something to happen because they whipped out this We Are at War immediately after the attacks. Zahner was in charge of the NSA unit that surveilled calls to and from, and I put Al-Qaeda in quotes, Al-Qaeda's global communications center in Yemen for a minimum of a year and a half before 9/11. They knew exactly what was coming down. The new Pearl Harbor and war memes were pushed by the mainstream media as the attacks were literally in progress, before either of the towers fell in New York, and they were smoking. This is just one example, but there are dozens. As the attacks were unfolding, the BBC in London began playing clips from Pearl Harbor. Tom Brokaw, NBC Today show, as the attacks were unfolding in New York, said, "There's been a declaration of war by terrorists. This is the most serious attack on the U.S. since Pearl Harbor." Time magazine, in its special September 2001 9/11 issue, said, quote, "What's needed in response to 9/11 is a unified, unifying Pearl Harbor sort of purple American fury, a ruthless indignation that doesn't leak away in just a week or two," unquote. Pearl Harbor was mentioned, war was mentioned by the mainstream media. 9/11 was clearly designed using the original Pearl Harbor attacks as its template. So what did the new Pearl Harbor insider script require the appearance of in the actual execution of the attacks of 9/11? They had to appear to be surprise attacks. They had to appear to be kamikaze pilot attacks. With planes this time used as weapons on buildings instead of ships. Both the original Pearl Harbor and 9/11 attacks were in the morning. There needed to be a critical mass of innocent deaths. The next slide after this one is truly chilling. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, and Bush both said immediately after the attacks they just couldn't imagine planes having ever been used as weapons in a kamikaze-like attack. Well, she is a historian, and a kamikaze attack triggered U.S. participation in World War II. It is, I simply can't imagine that Condoleezza Rice couldn't imagine. And Condoleezza Rice and Philip Zelikow, who became the executive director of the 911 Commission cover-up inquiry, and I put inquiry in quotes, were members of Bush Senior's A-team when he was president. They had co-published a book. They served on, as I mentioned, Bush Senior's National Security Council together, and Zelikow became her top aide plenipotentiary at the State Department when she moved to the State Department. And Zelikow, not surprisingly, in his own bio, states that he is an expert on creating public myths, you can read that as lies, and maintaining public presumptions about those lies, and call that cover-ups. He, Zelikow, was effectively the sole author of the 9/11 Commission report. He wrote its detailed outline before this so-called investigation even began, and Zelikow authored the Bush Doctrine for Unilateral Preemptive War under Condoleezza Rice at the State Department. I also interviewed Richard Clark, who was the so-called counterterrorism czar in the Bush Jr. Cheney White House. I interviewed him when I was at the Naval Postgraduate School, and he told me in an article that was actually, I published it on a DOD website online, that, quote, "the White House approved all major exercise scenarios in advance." Now, the White House can only mean the National Security Council. And our Vice President Cheney. And the National Security Council was headed by Condoleezza Rice, and the counterterrorism czar was Mr. Clark himself. So what does that mean? I was the original researcher who uncovered the reality of and the importance of as the modus operandi for the planning, execution, and cover-up of the real inside perpetrator attack of 9/11, that at the center of that were military exercises that were taking place on the morning of 9/11 itself that were on hijack scenarios. So what we're saying here is that Richard Clark himself, the White House counterterrorism czar before and on 9/11, told me personally, and I have published it on a DOD website, that he and Condoleezza Rice knew of and pre-approved the hijack scenario exercises taking place before and on 9/11. To succeed, the real inside job 9/11 PSYOP required a critical mass of innocent deaths. Believe it or not, after the World Trade Center attack in 1993 that killed, I believe, 5 people and injured about 1,000, federal agents were heard to say by reporter Stephen Emerson that, quote, there had not been enough deaths this time. After the 1993 World Trade Center attacks, also, most people don't know this, but the World Trade Center tower's roof doors were locked, ordered locked, by official New York City policy. So that on 9/11, it happened, because of that, that the innocent victims above the impact zones were trapped, terrorized, and killed. They had no way to escape, except to jump. And even the New York Times published that I believe 105 victims had gotten right up to the door, where in 1993 they were able to go onto the roof, but they were blocked. Also, after the impacts and before the towers fell, dozens of military and civilian helicopters self-dispatched, wonderful people from the military, started flying towards New York City, intending to rescue survivors from the towers, to risk their lives in their helicopters. They were ordered to go to a nearby military base so that they could not respond. On 9/11, 2 World Trade Center tower attacks, 15 minutes apart, of course, ensured the maximum PSYOP, ensured this maximum live audience for the second World Trade Center hit and the towers collapse. After the 9/11 attacks, Paul Wolfowitz, who was a top signatory and participant in the Project for New American Century manifesto, published exactly a year before 9/11, and was Deputy Secretary of Defense on 9/11, immediately under Donald Rumsfeld at the Pentagon, he actually had this to say about the critical mass of deaths in the 9/11 attacks. This is after 9/11 now. He predicted, before the final numbers were in, that the 9/11 attacks would soon be found to have resulted in a, quote, greater number of American deaths than any single day in U.S. history since the Civil War, more than any single day in World War I and World War II, and that Americans would now be willing to sacrifice their lives in great numbers for the cause of defeating terrorism, the so-called global war on terrorism. And quoted Winston Churchill, quote, America is like a great boiler. Once it gets fired up, the energy it generates is enormous. This was then echoed by Newsweek magazine immediately after, quote, more people were killed by the alleged suicide hijackers last week than the number of American soldiers killed in the entire American Revolution, or at Antietam, the bloodiest one-day battle of the Civil War, or at Pearl Harbor, or on D-Day. And locking the roof doors ensured that. But none of any of this would have succeeded without the Pentagon attack. So, proving its official story a lie, as Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and so many others have proven for the World Trade Center attacks, to prove that the Pentagon attack official story is a lie is so extremely important.
That's the voice of Barbara Honecker. Very heavy material. We have just played you the first 20 minutes of a 3-hour DVD. This is a presentation that Barb gave up in Seattle a couple of years ago, 3 hours long. She gives an incredible PowerPoint presentation, lots of graphics, lots of pictures, and you can follow along with everything she says because the DVD is so well produced. It's called Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't and Why It Matters. Barbara Honecker, 3 hours long. This is our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA of $100. $100, and we would be delighted to provide you with this information, research-packed, three-hour DVD Behind the Smoke Curtain. If you'd like to donate to KPFA today on Guns and Butter, please give us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can always pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. I'm here live in the studio, delighted to be joined by my co-producer on Guns and Butter, Tony Rango. Hi there, Tony.
Thanks, Bonnie. Nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you on board. You know, it's so wonderful to get some help. I'm oftentimes in here all alone, and it's certainly it's better for the audience too if there's two people in here. 1-800-439-5732. $100 Behind the Smoke Curtain is yours. A blockbuster 3-hour DVD. Barbara Honecker covers it all, everything with regard to 9/11 and specifically the Pentagon. Tony, you know, I thought we might say a little bit something about the Guns and Butter website before we go back.
We can jump into that. Before we get to that, I thought I would let folks know. I was just on the Amazon site about this movie, and it's full of 5-star ratings, including Bonnie's got one on there, a good quote from herself. But some really amazing stuff out there that people are saying about this movie. Blew my mind with her new film was this piece of one quote that I'm reading here. So it's really important that folks check this out.
Yeah, you know, Tony, I had forgotten that I had written a review of it, and Tony said to me, look at the reviews on Amazon, and I went in there and I looked at mine and I thought, oh, I like mine the best. So what I wrote about it is the most comprehensive, penetrating, and courageous presentation on the September 11th Pentagon attacks that I have seen. The presentation covers it all, beginning with the planning for a new American century by the neocons and Zionists, including a new Pearl Harbor to launch perpetual war and the setting up of a domestic police state. The seizure of power through the stolen 2000 presidential election, detailed and verified proof that the official Pentagon story is a lie, media complicity with the perpetrators beginning before, during, and after the event, what really happened, evidence for pre-placed explosives, evidence of the real perpetrators, the philosophical underpinnings of the masterminds. This is a riveting 3 hours, including graphics, photographs, and point-by-point slides. A must-see blockbuster, highly recommended. That's my review of this incredible gift. You can get this wonderful DVD and at the same time support KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732, securely online at kpfa.org. Tony?
Yeah, we'd like to thank the pledge coming in from San Jose that recently came in. We'd like to thank you very much for that. And we should maybe talk a little about the website that we've launched. And
Tony. Tony's been busy on the website. You know, everybody for years has been saying to me, Bonnie, why don't you get your website back up? Well, people think that that's a snap. It's not so easy. So what's going on with that, Tony?
So there's a website at gunsandbutter.org, and from there you can find archives, and we're putting up the new SoundCloud site that's got, I think, about 165 of your shows already posted with well over 7,000 listens and downloads. So people are finding it, whether they're your listeners or just people on SoundCloud. And then also an active Twitter feed that is posting things from the blog. So please go gunsandbutter.org to check it out and call in on this video.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. And I've been checking out the blog. You have to, it's a drop-down menu. Go to the blog. Tony's come up with some great articles. So that's a real resource, gunsandbutter.org. But right now, back to the business at hand, this is a fun drive for KPFA here on Guns and Butter. We're offering Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, and Why It Matters with Barbara Honecker. 3 hours long, riveting. It's heavy stuff, but boy, she has done the research. She's got the evidence. You can hear it. You can see it. $100 pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for this incredible 3-hour DVD. And then, of course, you are helping KPFA at the same time. A $25 donation makes you a voting member of KPFA and the Pacifica Foundation. So please, if you already have Behind the Smoke Curtain or you can't afford it, $25 goes a long way. You know, our old election supervisor, Les Radke, bless him, used to say that if everybody listening to KPFA out there donated $25, we wouldn't even need to have fund drives. So those $25 pledges are very important. If you want to be a member, you need to donate now. Don't wait. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, kpfa.org. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, and I'm joined by co-producer Tony Rango. Thank you for coming in, Tony. What do you think? Shall we start that second clip of Behind the Smoke Curtain with Barbara Honecker on the Pentagon attacks on 9/11?
Now, the official story also claims that Flight 77, a large Boeing 757, coming in very low at approximately 540 to 560 miles per hour, hit 5 light poles in a row, there they are, without exploding. But a 757 could not have hit one light pole, according to an expert I'm about to quote for you, let alone 5 in a row, and even made it to the wall without exploding. Why? Because the official story means that a 757, Flight 77 or otherwise, would had to have had still 11,250 gallons of flammable jet fuel in its wing tanks. Most people don't know, I certainly didn't until I did this research, that the largest, or two of the large, almost as large as the center fuselage tank, this is a graphic from Boeing's own website of its 757-200 series, which is what Flight 77 was, and this is flammable material, the jet fuel that is located in the two wing tanks, including tanks off to the way tips. And experts have told me, including Ralph Kolstad, who flew this very plane, he was very clear that the fuel in the center or fuselage body tank is used up first. And the official story says that Flight 77 or A-757 went out and turned around and came back. And before it hit the Pentagon, it was only out for an hour and 17 minutes. And it would have used the fuel from the center fuselage tank. And the tanks in the wings would have been flying fuel bombs. And the official story says that the leading edge of those two wings that are filled with still with fuel, according to the official story, hit 5 240-pound light poles like this in a row. When the impact, I found this wonderful image of a single flying bird does this to a wing. And here's an example of what a single flying goose does to the lightweight carbon fiber nose of a plane. And as I mentioned, I interviewed Ralph Kolstad, the Top Gun Navy pilot who flew the physical plane that was Flight 77 on 9/11. He said, if a 757 hit a light pole going at that high speed, it would rip open the wing, rip open the fuel tank in the wing. That wing would erupt into flames. The wings and probably the entire plane with it would have been destroyed before it could ever get to the building. When a leading edge of a wing of this jet hit just a single light pole, it sheared the wing entirely off, spilled jet fuel and wreckage over 100 feet, and crashed the plane to the ground. When the same thing happened to a large airliner, Now, that plane was smaller than a 757, but when the same kind of thing happened to a large airliner like Flight 77, which was in Detroit in 1987, 18 feet sheared off the left wing, which is the one that hit the light pole, when it hit two light poles, going at only 222 miles per hour, which was less than half the reported 540 to 560 miles per hour that Flight 77 was allegedly going when it allegedly hit five light poles in a row. And no wings or large wing pieces like this were found anywhere at or in the Pentagon. And even if Flight 77 or any large airliner had gotten through the light pole and tall 6-foot-high spools obstacle course, a plane couldn't have penetrated, I do not believe, the evidence shows, the newly hardened outer wall of the Pentagon. Wedge One's outer wall, which you see a graphic to the right from the Pentagon Building Performance Report, how the wall had been hardened after the Oklahoma City bombings. The Pentagon decided that they wanted to harden all of its outer walls to prevent that kind of an attack on the Pentagon. And Wedge One's outer wall, which includes where the official story says Flight 77 allegedly hit, had just been newly hardened to withstand terrorist attacks, specifically the kind that the official story says happened on 9/11. Now, this very much parallels, doesn't it, the World Trade Centers? Because we know that the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 were specifically designed to withstand the impact of a plane like the official story says hit those buildings on 9/11. Same thing with the Pentagon, in just that wedge. Interesting, isn't it? 2 feet thick after the upgrade, steel and Kevlar mesh. So the entire wall was like a huge bomb and plane-proof vest. This is what happened to the nose of a large airliner when it hit a non-reinforced wall. Unlike the hardened wall of the Pentagon on 9/11, far thinner than the Pentagon's wall, going at a mere fraction of the speed, I believe it was 88 miles per hour, claimed for Flight 77. To summarize this part, the official story at the Pentagon on 9/11 claims that after striking five light poles in a row, the leading edge of the wings, and somehow making it through the newly hardened wall that was specifically re-engineered to withstand just such a terrorist attack as at the World Trade Center, without its full wing fuel tanks exploding, which Ralph Cole said would have happened, a 757, according to the official story, then finally did explode, but only after it was almost entirely inside the building. And that, this is the official story now, that once inside the building, after being progressively shredded and dispersed over 285 feet, going in at a diagonal 45-degree angle, that it turned into a quasi-liquid unexploded fuel and debris slurry, and that slurry somehow magically reconstituted itself after going around all of these still standing columns into a perfectly focused cone of energy, which somehow magically cut this almost perfectly round alleged exit hole in the ceiling wall, despite there being, according to Duane Dietz, former NASA Director of Research Engineering, did an analysis of this slide from the Pentagon Building Performance Report. He has shown that there isn't a single path between the official story alleged entrance point or impact point of Flight 77 and the alleged exit hole in the C-ring that does not have multiple still standing columns in the way that would have dispersed this alleged quasi-liquid slurry. The FBI's official 911 investigation codename is Pent Bomb. It's not Pent Plane. And this stands for, officially, Pentagon Twin Towers Bombing. The FBI actually lied outright to one of the Jersey girls who had lost their husbands in the World Trade Center towers on 9/11, telling them that, quote, all of its investigation abbreviations end in bomb. This is a lie. The anthrax investigation, for instance, which is, of course, related to 9/11, does not. It is codenamed by the FBI Amerithrax, not Amerabomb. And as well, codenames for investigations known to be about bombings do end in bomb. For example, the Oklahoma City bombing investigation is codenamed Oak Bomb. So it should tell us something that the FBI's codename for the entire 9/11 investigation is Pent Bomb. that it was the code name of the entire 9/11 investigation was reconfirmed by the FBI's own director, Robert Mueller, in 2011. The terrorist hunter, this is the cover image on that issue, which is right after the alleged killing of Osama bin Laden. FBI Director Mueller to Time Magazine, May 10th, 2011. Quote, the FBI's Strategic Intelligence Operations Center filled to capacity on September 11th and remained that way through PENTBOM. The FBI's, this is still part of the director's quote, the FBI's cryptonym for Pentagon, Twin Towers, and bombing. The official story states there were no bombs at the Pentagon, that there were no bombs at the World Trade Center, that there were no pre-placed explosives, nanothermite or otherwise, at the World Trade Center or at the Pentagon. The FBI knows otherwise. The real story at the Pentagon, just as at the World Trade Center, is pre-placed explosives. Additional evidence for inside the building primary explosions at the Pentagon, similar to what you already know about pre-placed inside explosives at the World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7. Evidence that the Wedge 1 collapse, Wedge 1 again, the official story place of the alleged impact of Flight 77, evidence of the Wedge 1 collapse over the alleged plane penetration damage path on the inside of the building was in fact due to explosives. I'm about to give you that evidence, including possibly thermite. These are images on the top of the Oklahoma City Murrah Federal Building after it was known to have been destroyed by inside bombs as well as an outside truck bomb, but we know that there were at least four internal bombs in addition to the cover story outside rider truck bomb. And then at the bottom is the Pentagon after collapse of the section of Wedge 1 over the alleged impact point of Flight 77, using Al-Qaeda hijackers as the cover story. Witnesses to the sounds of a series of explosions also in the Pentagon use almost identical language to World Trade Center firefighters describing the going off of pre-placed controlled demolition explosives. So here are just some of these witnesses. Lieutenant McCowan, first floor D-ring in the Naval Command Center of the Pentagon on 9/11. Quote, it sounded like a series of explosions going off, a series of bombs exploding, similar to like firecrackers when you light them and you just get that series going off. Again, identical language to the description of firefighters from the Nade Brothers video of the World Trade Center saying they went off like firecrackers coming down. Lieutenant Colonel Thurman, second floor D-ring of the Pentagon on 9/11, to me it didn't seem like a plane. To me it seemed like it was a bomb. Being in the military, I've been around grenade and artillery explosions. In other words, he's been around bombs. It was a two-part explosion to me. It seemed like there was a percussion blast that blew me kind of backwards in my cubicle to the side, and then it seemed as if a massive explosion went off at the same time. This is a photograph from the Pentagon Building Performance Report of what's inside the columns of the West Wedge. These are reinforced steel supports. In fact, a massive explosion happened at just the time of the collapse of the outer wall over the alleged plane impact point, which is yet further evidence that another internal explosion caused that collapse. This is a live video clip from the Pentagon that morning. Note the time on the clip of 10:10 a.m.
That's the voice of Barbara Honecker. You're listening to the beginning of the second 20-minute clip from our pledge item today on Guns and Butter, Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. 3 hours, 3-hour-long DVDs. It's an incredible presentation, PowerPoint, pictures, graphs. You can follow along with her for 3 solid hours. She covers it all. Meticulous research. It's very riveting. And she concludes this DVD with the perpetrators. Behind the Smoke Curtain, our pledge item to you today for a tax-deductible donation to KPFA Radio. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Of course, I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I do want to thank a few people who have called in. We're getting a good response. There's Chris Dates up in Healdsburg. Hey, Chris, thanks a lot. He's a big supporter of KPFA. I'd also like to thank John Angus from Boulder Creek, California. Thank you, John. Also, a big thanks to Leah Monterosa in San Francisco. Also, thank you to Eric Nilsson in Sebastopol. You can join these supporters of Guns and Butter and KPFA by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. $100 for the DVD, $25 makes you a member. Hey, Tony, it looks like we just got a match.
Very nice.
Okay, we got a $900 match. There's some encouragement from Dave in Berkeley, Anonymous in Oakland, and Susan from Inverness. $900 match on Guns and Butter today. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. That makes your money go twice as far. What have you got there, Tony?
I've got a few thank yous as well. Judy Boston from Concord, Tony and Mary Jackson from Merced, David McFarland from Sonoma, David Van Giesen from Santa Rosa, and Rhonda Lewis from Fresno. Thank you, guys.
All right, Tony. 1-800-439-5732. $100 tax-deductible donation to KPFA behind the smoke curtain. What happened at the Pentagon on 9/11? What didn't? And why it matters. A three-hour-long DVD. Or you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. We've got a match of $900, so thank all of you for helping us bring it in for KPFA today on the Spring Fun Drive. Right now, you need to call 1-800-439-5732 to support this Spring Fun Drive here on KPFA. You can pledge online at kpfa.org or call 1-800-439-5732. We've gotten a very good response so far. We've got a $900 pledge, so we need some more calls to make that pledge. We've got 10 minutes to go. Behind the smoke curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11 and what didn't and why it matters with Barbara Honecker. I'm telling you, she covers, I don't know how to say it. I mean, she covers everything about the Pentagon. The light, you heard the stuff about the light poles. It was always claimed that, of course, a 757 hit the, if it was a 757, I'm getting my planes mixed up, hit the Pentagon because the light poles fell down. Well, Barbara shows that the fuel is in the wings and it wouldn't be able to smash through light poles. She goes on to explain the columns within the Pentagon are still standing in the path of what is officially claimed as the path of the plane entering the building. But the columns, a lot of the columns are still there. Then very interesting stuff about what goes on the inner rings, people talking about explosions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She deconstructs some of the controversial eyewitness testimony. I'm telling you, it's 3 hours jam-packed. And at the very end, she takes questions from the audience. So there's some Q&A at the end, and that's quite lively. That's Barbara Honecker, Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, why it matters. Our thank you gift today for a pledge to KPFA of $100, 1-800-439-5732. We're in a match period of $900. What have you got there, Tony?
I've got a few more thank yous. Mel Rosenthal from Oakland, David Walker from San Francisco, Peter Gill from Berkeley, and Karen Stern from Berkeley.
Oh, how nice. And thank you, Karen. And these are some people I know. This is wonderful because sometimes at public events, you know, I get to meet the listeners. Karen's a great. That's really nice. Thank you so much for those pledges. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member and enables you to vote in KPFA local station board. Very important to be involved in the governance of Pacifica. 1-800-439-5732. $25 makes you a member. $100, we'd be delighted to send you Barb Honecker's Behind the Smoke Curtain, 3 hours long. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter, if you just tuned in. I'm joined by Guns and Butter co-producer Tony Rango. Thank you, Tony. Tony's getting this stuff up on the website. I can't do this.
No problem, Bonnie.
So thank you, Tony. 1-800-439-5732, $100. We can, KPFA would be delighted to send you Barb Honecker's information-packed, research-packed presentation, Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, and Why It Matters. $100 for that. $25 makes you a member, but you've got to make that call. We've got, oh my goodness, we've only got 5-6 minutes left, 6 minutes to go. 1-800-439-5732. We're in a match period. 3 people have put up a very generous match of $900. Dave in Berkeley, anonymous in Oakland, and Susan from Inverness. 1-800-439-5732. What have you got? You've got some more pledges there, Tony?
Couple more. David from San Jose, thank you. That looks like Ron Martell from El Cerrito and Jerry Foster from Santa Rosa.
All right. Thank you. You can join all of these great supporters of KPFA and Guns and Butter at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You know, on the back of Barbara's DVD, there is a list of comments by some very top-level 9/11 researchers showing their support for her research. Quote, this will transform the discussion of what happened on 9/11. That from Professor David Ray Griffin. Richard Gage, of course, who Guns and Butter listeners are very familiar with, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, says, this presentation blew me away. Okay. Then we've got Professor Niels Herit, quote, I think you're the only Pentagon researcher who is both honest and presents a coherent model. There's a quote from Annie Michon, former MI5 British intelligence. I met her, very nice person. Well done on an excellent presentation. And on, Dr. Tim Eastman, a PhD plasma physicist. Actually, he worked with my friend, the late Todd Fletcher, on the Pentagon. Tim Eastman, a plasma physicist, says, quote, you've done a great job and an outstanding service to the 9/11 truth community and to our country, tirelessly separating the wheat from the chaff on the Pentagon question. We are all extremely grateful for this. Well, I'm grateful for it, too, because the Pentagon has been the most controversial subject with regard to the alternative 9/11 research. So kudos to Barbara Honecker for putting it all together. When she retired or resigned from her job, she's dedicated herself full time to 9/11 research. Behind the Smoke Curtain, What Happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, What Didn't, Why It Matters. Barbara Honecker, 3 hours long. Our gift to you today for $100, 1-800-439-5732, $100 for the DVD. We want to get some of those $25 pledges in here, too, for those of you who are not members, who want to become members and vote in our governance election. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm joined by co-producer Tony Rango. Well, Tony, any final thoughts? Anything we haven't mentioned about the website?
No, I think we've covered most of it. Just a kind of a quick rundown again. Make sure you give us your email at the bottom of any page for the newsletter so that you can stay informed about Guns and Butter. Go to SoundCloud, check it out. You can follow, share, and like there. Follow us on Twitter and stay informed and do check out the blog. And please do comment. We want to hear your feedback. It's a great way. And also, we've got a contact form on there. If you have suggestions or anything like that, we'll be getting back to you shortly.
Well, exactly. And, of course, it's very important if you want to stay on our mailing list that you have to actually, what, Tony, sign up? Is that it?
Right. You have to put your email in, and then it'll send you an email. It's sort of, it's called a double opt-in confirm. You put your email, and then you confirm via your email.
Well, so they don't make it easy, do they?
No.
I've got a couple more people to thank. Mel Douglas in Concord. Thanks, Mel. He called in and pledged today. Don Moore in San Francisco. Thank you, Dawn. You can join these two people and all the other people who have called. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for this incredible DVD. I'm telling you, you're not going to regret it. This thing is packed. And when I say packed, I mean packed with information, analysis, research, charts. You can follow along step by step with Barbara. It's very clear, and there's a lot there, and there's Q&A at the end, and she even goes into the perpetrators at the very end of Behind the Smoke Curtain, what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, what didn't, and why it matters. Please send me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at G-U-N-S-A-N-D-B-U-T-T-E-R.org. Of course, we're on Twitter. That's what, Tony? G&B Radio?
That's correct. Or you can find it from the website as well.
Yes, yes. We've got our Twitter feed up there on the website, kind of the way Webster Tarpley does it. We saw that. It looked pretty good, so we're trying that out. And, of course, there's a lot more to come on the website. Tony's busy at work on that. I got to hand it to Tony. He's got the energy. Looks like we made our match, Tony.
Excellent. Thank you all.
Thank you. We made that $900 match. I want to thank you all so very, very much for all your great support for Guns and Butter and for KPFA.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we return to Phyllis Bennis's extremely interesting talk on why a military response to ISIS cannot work, but diplomacy can. I hope you'll stay tuned. We return to the interesting talk Phyllis Bennis recently gave in Seattle. Bennis is a highly regarded researcher and progressive activist. She has a particular interest in Middle Eastern affairs and U.S. foreign policy. In Seattle, she spoke on the militant Islamist extremist group ISIS. She showed how U.S. military interventions in the Middle East help create ISIS, especially our disastrous war and even more disastrous occupation of Iraq. Another cause of ISIS is the 8 or 9 disastrous proxy wars now being waged in Syria. Not all of these Syrian conflicts are our fault, but some are. Bennis argues that all U.S. military actions in the Middle East have failed. Necessarily failed. That includes all military actions taken against ISIS in recent months. They too have failed. She argues that there is no military solution to the problem of ISIS. Rather than further escalate the war against ISIS, we need diplomacy and negotiation. And if you think that war can solve this problem, but negotiating with militants cannot, I'll just add two words. Northern Ireland. When we paused the talk last week, Bennis was discussing the huge economic costs to Americans of our military response to ISIS. Today she'll continue with a big reason that some powerful people want a military response to ISIS, even if that response cannot work. That's because war brings big profits to the fat cats who own the so-called defense industries. Here again is Phyllis Bennis.
What makes us safer? Jobs and health care? And education at home? Or wasting our money on wars around the world that make people hate us and turn against us and turn to terrorism? We hear so often, no one wants war. It's not true. It's never been true. There are powerful forces who want war because they profit from war. The old saying, cui bono, who profits? Still, follow the money. That's still the answer here. Those who profit are the ones who want the war. You know, in all of history, people who produce war goods, the weapons, that sort of thing, have always been wealthy, always been powerful, the war profiteers. But if you look at U.S. history, more recently, in the period right after 9/11, in that first year, the war profiteers, the CEOs of war-producing companies, got a 200% raise on average. All the other overpaid CEOs got a 7% raise. Now you tell me they don't want war. They want war because it's profitable. They want war because they want a market for all of their military goods. And they find it. Because we are told over and over again it's either war or nothing. And that's the lie. It's the lie that George Bush told us overtly. It's the lie that current administrations and Congresses continue to act on. So we have this ongoing conflict in the region, across the region. Some of them new. Some are old. The question of Israel-Palestine remains central to the crisis in the region. If you look at the positive days of the Arab Spring, when it looked so hopeful, so optimistic, that citizens' organizations, citizens' movements, democratic movements were rising all around the region, And the demands were the demands of the rights of citizenship. And the demands were for jobs and for bread. They were basic rights. But if you talked to any of those activists, you didn't have to scratch the surface very hard to find out that part of the anger that motivated it was seeing how Palestinians were being treated over the decades, seeing the expansion of settlements, seeing the siege of Gaza continuing over and over again, and every 2 years a new assault on Gaza with thousands of Palestinian deaths and no accountability. No one held accountable. War crimes identified and seen around the world, and no one held accountable because the United States continued to protect Israel in the United Nations. So we have this colonial reality that shaped so much of the history of the rest of the world. The Arab world has not forgotten British and French colonialism. You know, we hear about ISIS saying that the colonial border between Iraq and Syria is no more. The Sykes-Picot lines in the sand should be abolished. But they're hardly the first ones to say that. They're the first ones to take up arms to make it happen at a horrific human price. But they're not the first ones to say the colonial powers have destroyed our region, stolen our oil, destroyed our people. And the leftover colonial expansion is going on inside Israel, enabled by the United States, with the European Union rebuilding Gaza every time it's destroyed, and then standing back and not holding Israel accountable where it goes in and destroys it again. The irony, of course, we're talking about extremists. We're talking about the extremism of ISIS that operates in the name of Islam. In the settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, it's about 650,000 people who are violating international law every morning just by getting out of bed because their houses are built on illegally expropriated land. But only about 20% of them, maybe 25%, are extremists, either religious or nationalist extremists. The rest are what we might call yuppie settlers. They move to the West Bank for the same reasons that people in this country move to the suburbs. The air is cleaner, the houses are bigger, the lawns are greener, the swimming pools are sparklinger. What's not to like? And it's all subsidized by the Israeli government, helped along by our tax money. We pay $3.1 billion a year directly to the Israeli military. It's soon going to go up to five. The new 10-year agreement is being negotiated right now, and it looks like that's going to be part of the payoff to Israel after the Iran deal. The consolation prize is that it's going to go from $3.1 billion a year to the military to $5 billion a year to the military. $5 billion every year of our tax money going to the military of the 26th wealthiest country in the world for their military, which is known around the world for committing war crimes. Is that a good use of our tax money? Is that going to make us safer? These are the questions that are not being asked enough. We use the term apartheid when we talk about this colonial enterprise, not because it's a shocking term and it gets people talking about how can you say Israel is apartheid, it's not like South Africa. The answer is, of course, it's not like South Africa. It's completely different. That's not why we use the term. We use the term because it's the exact definition of apartheid that's included in the UN Covenant Against the Crime of Apartheid that was passed in 1973. That says that when you have a single territory with two separate legal systems governed by the same government, where people are divided on the basis of race or religion, national origin or language, that's the definition of apartheid. Look at the West Bank. Imagine a 12-year-old kid on the West Bank throws a stone. If that kid is an Israeli kid, he's going to be taken to a juvenile court, very much like our courts. They don't work well all the time, but the idea of juvenile courts is they are built to work in the interest of the child. The child is considered a child, even if they have committed a crime. The goal of the court is to help get the kid education and help whatever's needed to get the kid back on track. That's appropriate. That's what would happen to an Israeli kid in the West Bank. If that kid in the West Bank who throws a stone is a 12-year-old Palestinian kid, that kid appears before a military court. Israel is the only country in the world that has created a juvenile military court. At 14, Palestinian kids, Israeli kids are in a juvenile court up to 18. At 14, Israeli kids go before the regular military court, with all that that implies. So this is the definition of apartheid, and it's the reason that we talk about solutions that apply across the board. We need a solution to the war in Syria that's based on international law, human rights, and equality for all. We need an end to Israeli occupation and apartheid and a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's based on international law and human rights and equality for all. Whether it's one state, two state, red state, blue state, that's not our call. That's not for the U.S. I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't live there. Why should I get to say how many states there are? It's not my job. My job is to hold my government accountable for a policy to be based on international law and human rights and equality for all, instead of a policy that's based on supporting occupation and apartheid. In Syria, my job is to say we need to stop supporting militarization and war and start supporting diplomacy and negotiations. We need to stop paying billions of dollars to buy weapons and start paying billions of dollars to rebuild the countries we have destroyed. That's our job. That's the kind of work that we need to focus on. I want to end with two points. One is something that former Senator George Mitchell taught all of us, I think, after his work in the Good Friday Accord in Northern Ireland that he was instrumental in helping to craft. And after that very long process, which had been almost impossible at the beginning, partly because the British view was the Provisional IRA are terrorists and we will not talk to them. They cannot be in the room. And the lesson that Senator Mitchell brought back and what he had imposed at the time was, if you're serious about diplomacy, everybody has to be in the room. Not because you like them, but precisely because you don't. And if they're not in the room, they're not bound by whatever you decide. So this notion that we can have talks in Syria with the Syrian Kurds, who are admittedly the U.S.'s best friend in the region, who are fighting ISIS more than anybody else, but they can't be there because Turkey won't come if they're there, that's not going to work. You don't have to like what the Kurds stand for. You don't have to like what Turkey stands for. But they're on opposite sides, and if they're not both in the room, one or the other is going to scuttle the deal. So that's the pragmatism of it. That's the pragmatic part, that everybody has to be in the room. That's not idealist. That's being pragmatic. The one other thing I want to say is that this notion that the only option is the option of war is a very dangerous reality for our country. The idea of American exceptionalism, which is now touted as a given, something to be held up with pride by every candidate for president of every party. No one is willing to say, no, we are not exceptional. We are exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally powerful. But we are not an exceptional nation. We are a nation struggling to do what we claim to believe in, that we claim to believe in things like equality. And we struggle to make that real. We are not exceptional. We got a lot of work to do. But we do have obligations, the obligations that come with power and that come with money, all of those things that we have too much of. We don't have too much humility. We could use a little more of that. But it means that we need real policies. It's not enough to say we can't go to war. It's not going to work. The option is not walk away. The option is not, this is not a Rand Paul isolationism. You know, once in a while he says something very interesting on the need to end wars, the need not to send troops. I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. Until he gets to, yeah, and we have to pull out of the United Nations and stop dealing with any other countries. Okay, this is, you know, that's not going to work so well either. So what would a policy look like? If we are talking about a policy based on human rights and equality for all and international law, maybe we start with the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. Stop killing more people. If you're trying to stop a war that has already in Syria killed more than 250,000 people, stop killing more people in the name of stopping the war. That could be number one. That's not a bad idea. Number two, you claim there are no boots on the ground. Make that real. Pull them out. Pull out the 3,700 troops that are on the ground in Iraq and the 50 or so that are officially on the ground in Syria. We don't know how many more. All those special forces and CIA ops. Maybe they wear sneakers and not boots, but get them out too. Get them all out. Get all the shoes out. Get all the shoes out. They're making it worse and not better. Number three, stop sending more weapons for all these forces to be killing each other. Stop sending more bombs and bombers to the Saudis to kill more Yemenis. Stop sending more, whatever they're sending in tanks and trucks and more bombs and more bullets to the so-called Syrian opposition that the U.S. doesn't even know who they're sending it to, not least because almost all of it ends up in the hands of ISIS. Because ISIS is stronger. We remember why. One, they don't fight alone. They fight with others. Number two, they pay higher wages to their militias. That's one of the ironies of it all. Number four, five, six, ten, do better diplomacy. Put all of the money and energy and high-level attention into the diplomacy that we're now putting into the war. And in the meantime, stop the war to make that diplomacy real. Use the money to vastly increase our contributions to the United Nations to take care of refugees. The vast majority of refugees don't want to come here. They're not trying to invade our country. They don't want to be in the United States. They want to be able to go home. Some of them do have to be resettled, and we should take more. We should be taking 28% of those refugees who do need to be resettled. Why? Because we represent 28% of the wealth of the world, even though we only have 5% of the population of the world. The least we could do is say we will take 28% of those refugees who need resettlement. There's small things we can do. We could overturn the Supreme Court decision, Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. Why? Because that law makes it illegal for anyone in the United States to provide nonviolence training to any organization on the terrorism list. So if somebody could get to the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Party in Turkey, or ISIS for that matter, and train some of them in nonviolent techniques of protest instead of war, that would be a crime punishable by 20 years in a federal prison. How sensible is that? That's a small thing. We should be able to do that. We can increase economic pressure on the oil companies that are making a killing on ISIS oil. Now, what government is going to be prepared to put the pressure on the oil companies? That shouldn't be so hard, given that we claim that everything about our country is mobilized to stop terrorism, except, well, the oil companies, they're kind of exempt. There's a lot to do. And at the end of the day, we still owe a huge debt to the people of Syria. We still owe an enormous debt to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia, the countries where we are sending drones, the people of the countries that we have destroyed. Some of you will remember, looking around, I think many of you will remember, Colin Powell's claim during the Iraq War. Remember his famous statement that he used to say over and over again, the Pottery Barn line, you break it, you fix it. We have to fix Iraq. That was the wrong analogy. It's not about Pottery Barn. The right analogy is the bull in the china shop. What do you do when the bull gets loose in the china shop? You don't go in and ask the bull to fix all the cups. You get the bull the hell out of the china shop and write a check for the damage. That's what we need to be doing in Iraq. That's what we need to be doing in Afghanistan. It's going to be generations before these countries can reclaim their social existence, their lives, rebuild their cities. It's not going to help to have us standing there with guns telling them how to do it. That's the guarantee of failure. We need to guarantee success. We've had 15 years of a failed war on terror. I think maybe it's time for 15 years of paying the price for what we did wrong. Thank you.
Phyllis Benes, concluding her talk on why there is no military solution to ISIS aggression. War cannot solve this problem, but diplomacy might. I'm glad Benes reminded us of the long and bloody guerrilla war between the anti-British Catholic militant extremists and pro-British Protestant militant extremists in Northern Ireland. For most of my life, that bloody conflict seemed intractable, with no end in sight. Then it ended, with no military victory on either side. It ended after some serious diplomacy and negotiation. That conflict resolution was spearheaded by the United States. The international negotiation was chaired by Senator George Mitchell of the United States. An agreement was signed in 1998. The militant Irish Republican Army disarmed. The war quickly came to an end, and peace has endured. I remember the time well. This was a stunning victory for diplomacy. It was the only admirable instance of U.S. foreign policy that I can think of in my lifetime. Okay, that and Eisenhower's abrupt ending of Harry Truman's war against North Korea and China. Pretty much the first thing Eisenhower did when he took office in 1953. But since the 1998 Northern Ireland peace agreement was bad for the defense industry profits, after an initial splash, the U.S. media and the State Department have agreed to forget the whole matter. And so we did. So thank you, Phyllis Benes, for the much-needed reminder. Speaking of issues that the media don't want to talk about, let's hear a bit of the Q&A that followed Dennis's speech. The questioner brought up Saudi Arabia's funding of ISIS and other terrorism throughout the world. How come nobody talks about that?
Why are you leaving out the elephant in the room, which is the active support, creation, funding by the United States, by its allies, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, of ISIS and these other elements like ISIS?
The question of U.S. and Saudi support for ISIS is a longstanding issue. The U.S. support came in the form of creating the conditions which gave rise to ISIS and imprisoning the people who would ultimately create ISIS. The issue of where the money comes from is a very complicated one. Much of it, if you had to pick one country that the money for ISIS comes from, it comes from Saudi Arabia. We've known that for a long time. That's one of the big questions of what are the Saudis doing and not doing to stop the money from going through. It goes to the question of what is Turkey doing or not doing to prevent fighters from going through. That's an ongoing question. These are countries allied with the U.S. This is a huge challenge to the U.S. claims that it is against ISIS in all its forms when its allies have been responsible. One of the things we don't know, because the system in Saudi Arabia is so opaque, is the degree to which the money that goes from the Saudis to ISIS comes from the royal family versus coming from some government officials versus coming from pro-government institutions of various sorts versus coming from wealthy Saudi individuals or businesses. No one's been able to track that. We know it comes from Saudi Arabia. We don't know how much of it comes from the government or not the government. What we do know, and what nobody's hiding this, this is all over my book, which you can read. One of the things that we do know is that the Saudi system is tightly controlled enough that regardless of whether the money was coming from government sources or not, the government does have the capacity to stop it. It's choosing not to do that. The U.S. is choosing to not pressure them to do that because of relations of oil and relations of weapons sales. Those are still the things that define the U.S.-Saudi relationship. So, yeah, that hasn't changed. I don't think that's the only elephant in the room. But, yeah, it's one of the things that hasn't changed.
Not a very good answer to the question, I think, but a long one. The issue raised is important, though. It's also an issue the establishment doesn't want raised about 9/11. I happen to think that the government's official story of 9/11 is preposterous, and the official 9/11 Commission report is an inept attempt at whitewash. It's so bad, it makes you appreciate the highly skilled and much more credible whitewash that is the Warren Commission report on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That's because the so-called Warren Commission was run by the brilliant master of deceit, fired CIA Director Alan W. Dulles, whereas the 9/11 Commission was run by the right-wing neocon hack Philip Zelikow. But if we were to take the official story of 9/11 seriously, even that says that 16 of the 19 alleged hijackers were citizens of Saudi Arabia. The alleged mastermind was a prominent businessman of Saudi Arabia, and the whole 9/11 terrorist operation was funded mainly by money from, you guessed it, Saudi Arabia. So, the United States military revenge for 9/11 was directed at Afghanistan, which had fairly little connection to 9/11, and then at Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11 whatsoever. Now, I majored in English, not political science. So the fact that none of this makes any logical sense to me may be just a sign of my faulty education. I don't know. I do know, though, that we are out of time. Thanks again to Mike McCormick for the original recording. Thanks to Phyllis Bennis for a very good talk. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. Check out our archive of past shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good day, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. April 15th marked the 3rd anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. And like 9/11, things just don't quite add up. There are many, many unanswered questions and what appears to be a cover-up going on. Here with me today to discuss these two events is attorney John Remington Graham. John Graham is an attorney with decades of experience in the fields of constitutional, environmental, and criminal litigation. He served as a federal public defender special counsel to the city of Brainerd, Minnesota. He received both a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy and a law degree from the University of Minnesota. He has also worked on legal issues with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth and Jokar Sainayev's aunt, who is also a lawyer. Today you'll hear the first half of this interview. Jack Graham, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background as an attorney.
I've been a criminal lawyer now for about 50 years. I was admitted to the Minnesota Bar in 1967, and since then I have practiced over many different states, and I'm also a constitutional lawyer. I have both prosecuted and defended, and I have a background in forensic medicine and science, and I was a founding professor of an accredited law school in my native Minnesota, where I taught about 10 years. So I've been around the block and seen quite a bit of the way our criminal justice system works.
You were involved legally both with 9/11 and with the Boston Marathon bombing. So I want to talk about both of those today. But let's start first with 9/11. Maybe you could tell us about how you first started questioning 9/11 and then how you got involved with the Architects and Engineers.
Well, what happened was that I had been involved in a number of cases involving the presentation of technical, scientific, and medical evidence in court. We call that forensic medicine and science and medicine. And I'd use this kind of evidence in criminal cases and in civil litigation. And for some years, I worked on water fluoridation, which is a very controversial subject. But I tried 3 major cases, one in Pennsylvania, one in Illinois, and one in Texas. And the 3 judges, after long trials, held in either case that fluoridation of public water supplies causes cancer and other ailments in man. Characteristic of this was evidence by the United States government, which covered up or obscured the meaning of laboratory or scientific evidence or epidemiological evidence showing that water fluoridation causes cancer-related reactions in laboratory mice and is associated with huge increases in water fluoridation of cancer in man. 3 judges in a row found that water fluoridation caused cancer. And the Union of Scientists at the U.S. EPA reviewed the evidence, found that the judges were scientifically correct, and so reported to Congress. So I had been through this experience that had covered a good many years, awakened to the reality that the government of the United States is fully capable of cynical use of quack science, detrimental to the health and well-being of the United States in order to promote some political agenda. That was a very difficult experience for me to go through and to absorb without losing faith in my country. But it was not impossible for me to understand that the government of the United States was capable of genocide or something equivalent to genocide, some terrible, terrible acts. Now, on 9/11, I landed in an airport near New York City in Newark, New Jersey, And my plane, of course, was grounded for 5 days, and it was an unforgettable experience. But I really didn't understand what had happened until I encountered some scientists, some architects, engineers, demolition experts, and people involved in related branches of the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, and so on, who introduced me to the reality that the buildings on 9/11 came down from controlled demolition. Ordinarily, that would have been impossible for me to believe, except that my experience with water fluoridation showed that the government of the United States is capable of using quack science for political purposes. So I listened very carefully. I then got to know Richard Gage and people who were associated with his organization, which is based in California, and but it's formed around a nucleus of now 2,400 qualified architects, engineers, and demolition experts in the United States, Canada, and Europe, who had examined the facts and concluded that the buildings had come down from controlled demolition. And I can summarize the evidence for you. The evidence, and it took me a while to understand this, I can say it fairly fast now, but it took me well over a year and a half just focusing on almost a daily basis. And I had, for a long time, had no opinion on it one way or another. And I was satisfied at the conclusion of my work that there was no other reasonable conclusion. First place, the design and durability of these buildings was strong enough to withstand office fires and aircraft collision, which could not possibly have caused a collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7 as observed on the 11th of September 2001, or what we now call 9/11. The opinions of the architects and engineers and demolition experts are impressive enough, but think about it. There were 343 members of the best-trained fire department in the world, New York City, and they know buildings from state-of-the-art knowledge, and they were risking their lives on the fact that these buildings could not come down from aircraft collision and office fires as observed. They had 343 members of the department in there, including their chief, and they were calling up to people on the upper floors and saying, stay where you are, we're going to come up and get you. They had no reason to believe that these buildings were going to come down. And yet they came down in ways which all of us have seen and on television and so forth. And it was really frightening thing. Okay, that's the first thing that we see. The buildings couldn't come down from office fires and aircraft collision. That's a physical impossibility. Yet they did. Second, if you look at each of the buildings, came down at free fall or near free fall speed, symmetrically, each into its own footprint. And that is visibly indistinguishable from controlled demolition. If they hadn't been for controlled demolition, the buildings would have tipped onto adjacent property. That isn't what happened. They just each collapse into its own footprint at a very rapid rate of speed, which means that the inner columns in the buildings had been compromised. And as each building came down, take just the Twin Towers, we have lateral ejection of hundreds of steel beams, clot speed of about 60 miles an hour, and approximately 90,000 tons of concrete, pulverization, mid-air pulverization of many tons of concrete in mid-air, and that's characteristic of explosions. At ground zero, we found tons of iron-rich microspheres, which means that the steel had actually melted, and that would require ultra-high temperatures, about 4,800 degrees Fahrenheit. That's just much higher than aircraft collision or office fires could cause. And the steel had actually melted. There was also an international team of scientists who found unignited chips of nanothermite, which is a high-tech incendiary manufactured only by the most advanced laboratories in the defense industry. And finally, we have over 150 witnesses, most of them firefighters, peace officers, first responders, and some journalists who have given statements that are recorded and have been preserved and can be recapitulated in court testimony, where they actually heard explosions as the Twin Towers came down, like boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. And so when you hear that, when you see all these facts, the only rational conclusion is controlled demolition. And those who try to talk around this because they don't want to believe it, or they can't accept what it means, or they have some ulterior purpose in trying to continue deception of the American people. Their arguments don't make any sense.
I understand you were involved legally with Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Yeah, well, what we did was on behalf of Architects and Engineers and 9/11 Truth, which is the premier organization in the world, I petitioned the state district attorney in New York City seeking a grand jury and a special prosecutor. We wanted to meet with Mr. Vance nor chosen members of his staff under circumstances of confidentiality that he would establish to discuss this possibility. His first response was that, well, this is a federal matter, which is nonsense because the state of New York has jurisdiction over murder, manslaughter, treason, arson, and so that was not really a very convincing way to brush this aside. And then we came back with further evidence and a second offer of proof where we had evidence of security contracts put out by the New York, New Jersey Port Authority, which had jurisdiction over the World Trade Center and safety issues. And these security contracts were being executed during the year prior to 9/11, and the execution of these contracts would have given those in charge the capacity to provide access to workers who could have installed the explosive. These even included access to elevator shafts. So it was a terrible thing. Another very interesting fact that I haven't really mentioned is that Building 7 came down like the Twin Towers. This steel frame skyscraper was not struck by aircraft. So we know that this could not have been caused by aircraft collision and office fires. Office fires are never sufficient.
So where does this stand now with Cyrus Vance and the city of New York?
Well, that was just a typical reaction of all public authority in the United States. Nobody wants to believe it. Neither Congress, nor the 9/11 Commission, nor FEMA, nor NIST, nor the FBI ever have examined the possibility that these buildings came down from controlled demolition.
So right now it's just a done deal at this point?
Well, all we have is the government of the United States is doing its best to cover this up. The reason is probably easy enough to understand. If the country as a whole or a substantial majority of Americans were able to understand what actually happened, but this was really an inside job. I mean, if there was controlled demolition involved, then there was an inside job of one kind or another. You can make what you want. It depends on how you connect the dots. But we have plenty of circumstantial evidence that would permit a subpoena-driven investigation to find out who the culprits were. And it was found out by the American people and really understood that this was an inside job, that the government of the United States was in one way or another involved, and that Osama bin Laden could not have been primarily responsible. I mean, you know, we talk about conspiracy theories. Well, how could you say that a man in Afghanistan and 19 suicidal fanatics were able to penetrate the most sophisticated air defense system in the world? That is the only conspiracy that is really out there.
Right.
And it's a ridiculous conspiracy theory, abusive of circumstantial evidence. It's a ridiculous conspiracy theory. If you can see that the buildings came down from controlled demolition, then you know that it had to be executed methodically over many months, and that is what happened because otherwise controlled demolition wouldn't be possible, but controlled demolition is manifest from the external evidence that I've just described. If people found out, we'd probably have a revolution, a dramatic, legal, and peaceable transformation such as occurred in England when Charles I was restored to the throne in 1660, or what we call the Glorious Revolution, where the crown was transferred from James II to William and Mary. Those are examples of peaceable and lawful revolutions. We would have something similar like that in the United States.
So we have 9/11, and then similar to 9/11, I think anyway, is the Boston Marathon bombing, and you've also been involved in that legally. Maybe you can talk about your role with that.
Well, what I did in that case was I represented the Russian aunt of Zokhar Tsarnaev, the accused Chechenian American boy who was prosecuted and convicted and sentenced to death. And he is now in Florence, Colorado, in a federal high-security prison waiting execution as appeals are underway right now. And I represented Merit Tsarnaeva, who lives in Russia, and she is the paternal aunt of Zokhar. She is a lawyer. She is qualified to practice in the Kyrgyz Republic, which was once part of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union. And I helped her file an intervention asking for permission to appear as a friend of the court. And she laid out evidence which clearly enough shows that Zokhar could not be guilty. And that sounds pretty dramatic for someone who reads the newspapers and gives the newspapers and news media of this country any degree of credibility. But the proof that he couldn't have committed the crime is pretty simple. On the 16th of April, 2013, the day after the explosions, the FBI crime lab, from fragments at the scene of the explosions, projected that the culprits, whoever they were carrying large, heavy-laden black backpacks concealing pressure cooker bombs that were made from a certain style of a trademark and type of pressure cooker that was marketed in the Boston area at Macy's. And that is clear, that much from the crime lab is unquestionable. No one can challenge it or defeat it. And it was, the government did not just take this as an investigative hypothesis. The black backpacks are incorporated into the general allegations of the indictment, and the government went into trial with this premise as part of their case.
So what are they doing, ignoring the fact that the kids' backpacks were a different color?
Well, here's, on the 18th of April, the FBI came out with what was known as the Whiskey's Steakhouse video, from which two still frames were taken to make wanted posters to advise the public who the suspects were and to solicit support of the public in helping them make an apprehension. You can't tell from the two still frames that were used for the wanted posters, but there is a third still frame which shows Zokhar, who is the person accused, from the rear, and it shows that just a few minutes before the explosions, in the same video that was used to identify the culprit by the FBI, he was carrying over his right shoulder a small, flat, white backpack. And so that excludes him, according to the projections of the FBI crime lab, which in turn were incorporated into the indictment. And interestingly enough, and this is not the end of the story, there were photographs at or near the scene of the crime at approximately the time of the explosions, showing a number of individuals wearing military-style jackets, pants, and boots, and wearing caps with identical logos, carrying precisely the kind of backpacks which the FBI crime laboratory projected. And those people were never questioned or arrested or charged. And so here we have, going into the trial, a case where the accused was obviously not guilty, and they had made a mistake at best, but I don't think it was a mistake because they couldn't possibly have missed the fact that Zokhar's backpack didn't match the projections of the FBI crime laboratory and the general allegations of the indictment. They knew about this, and yet we have, and the defense lawyers could have, on the basis of this information alone, made a motion to dismiss the indictment, which they didn't do. They went into trial, and in the opening statement, Judy Clark, the court-appointed lawyer for the accused, forcefully stated that he was guilty.
Yeah, when that happened, I thought that was really strange. Is that unusual for a lawyer to do?
If you have somebody who is guilty, what you do is you plead guilty and then make a dramatic appeal to the mercy of the court, which is what Clarence Darrow used to do. But you wouldn't go into trial and forcibly admit your client was guilty, then fail to produce the exculpatory evidence, which they didn't do. The white backpack was never shown to the jury. The photographs of the individuals who were carrying large, heavy black backpacks were never introduced. None of the exculpatory evidence was introduced. And in the final summation before the jury, Judy Clark didn't even ask for a not guilty verdict.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
The main facts have been published of the intervention of Merit Tsarnaeva had been published by Paul Craig Roberts in two articles that he published, and one was on the 17th of August, 2015, and another was more recently, the 29th of March, 2016. The documents of her intervention were ordered part of the record of the case, and they are accessible. They are part of the official judicial record, and it clearly shows that Zokar could not have been the guilty party and that his lawyers did not make any effort to introduce such evidence. It also includes an affidavit by Merit Tsarnaeva about her encounter with the court-appointed lawyers, and she did her best to get lawyers who would actually defend her nephew, and how they brushed her aside, and it was not possible to get effective representation for this young man.
Are there people in the legal profession other than yourself, are there people concerned about this?
Well, I've talked to a number of lawyers, and yes, there are a lot of lawyers who are interested and who see this, but they haven't been willing or able to get involved. When I went to Massachusetts, I wanted to be admitted to the Federal District Court in Boston so that I could assist Merit Tsarnaeva. My paralegal assistant and I spoke to a number of lawyers. I spoke to the American Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts. Even they wouldn't come to our assistance. And Massachusetts has quite a distinguished background in the field of civil liberty, so this should not be difficult. I found one lawyer after the fact, whom I got to know, a fellow from New Bedford, who said he was very sorry that this had happened and he would have been glad to have intervened in our behalf if he had known about it, but we hadn't talked to him. But anyway, here we are. We had made contact with literally hundreds of lawyers, and the story was the same. Any lawyer who would have anything to do with helping this young man would have been damaged in his professional standing and would have lost business. So there was a great deal of intimidation. This is a case which was what we would call a show trial. We had the prosecutors, counsel for the accused, and the major news media all marching in lockstep, creating an impression that Zokar was guilty. And they do it by systematic exclusion of the exculpatory facts, emphasizing supposed confession statements which are disproved by the objective facts. So here we are. The legal profession in this country did not get involved because they were intimidated. And that's pretty serious. I mean, lawyers are supposed to be the leaders in protecting men who are not guilty. Here I have been a lawyer now, I'm 75, and have had the bulk of my career. And so I was able to get involved, and I assumed that I might get involved in a supporting capacity, maybe give some advice, but that there would be swarms of good lawyers that would be wanting to get involved and defend this young man. It was just the opposite. Very striking, because the news media so overwhelmingly deceived the American people on what really was going on in that case that lawyers were afraid to get involved. I've never seen that happen before.
Yeah, that's really very frightening, actually, if they're afraid to do it. Tell me, where does the trial stand now? What's next?
It's right now on appeal to the First Circuit, and I'm pretty sure the First Circuit isn't going to do anything. So the only thing I can do is to publish the actual documents of record. I've even contacted the new lawyer for Zokar Tsarnaev on the appeal and have offered to send her all the documents, which I had also sent to Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General of the United States.
Now, is this lawyer a government lawyer, or is it one the family has chosen?
No, it's not a family lawyer. The family hasn't been able to hire anybody.
Now, how do they get away with that?
If you check out the report of Paul Craig Roberts on the 17th of August, 2015, you will see an affidavit by Merit Tsarnaeva dated the 17th of April, 2015, where the interaction between the public defenders from Boston and her family are outlined. And you can see, for example, Merit suggested that the family hire independent counsel to work with them. And they said, if you do that, we'll withdraw from the case. And the government will make it very difficult for that lawyer. he will find life very, very difficult if he tries to get involved. So this is a case, the impression that Merritt gives in her affidavit is that the mother, Zubidat, cooperated with these, with Judy Clark and her colleagues in the Boston Public Defender's Office in order to effectively betray him.
Wow.
So I have all of the documents. And you can look at Paul Craig Roberts' report. You can get it, Paul Craig Roberts, August 17, 2015, or FBI evidence shows innocence. You can Google that. You'll
right.
get the report, and you'll see the actual documents that are a public record reproduced verbatim.
So I know on the day of the Boston Marathon bombing, there was a drill going on, and you mentioned those guys dressed up in you know, khaki pants and black shirts, et cetera, and having wearing the hat with the same emblem. And I believe they were from the paramilitary organization, the CRAF.
It is known as CRAF International. And the logo that they were wearing was the logo of CRAF International, which is a paramilitary organization.
Right, so that's a little frightening, and I know most of the false flag events have drills going on, so that to me is a clear sign that, you know, we need to look a little deeper into this. So.
Well, Dr. James Fetzer has published a number of films of the and videos of the event, and you can hear them saying, this is a drill, this is a drill. I'm not saying that I agree with Dr. Fetzer or don't disagree with him about this or some other episode. I'm merely pointing out there's another very interesting observation by Dr. Lorraine Day, who is an eminent trauma surgeon. She was the top trauma surgeon in San Francisco for many years, and she said that when she looked at news reports of the scene of the explosion, that she made two observations that were very striking. First is that blood did not appear when it was supposed to appear, and as a trauma surgeon, she should know. And that when the blood did appear, it wasn't the right color. It wasn't the dark maroon. It was kind of a bright orange-red kind of Hollywood blood. That was very disturbing. I don't know what to make of that, and I'm not relying on it. But what I do know is that the backsatch don't match, and that therefore the government did not have even probable cause to proceed against Socrates Sarnaev, and he was not competently defended by lawyers who were trying to get him off. He was defended by lawyers who were trying to cooperate with the government in convicting him.
And again, you were just listening to the first half of an interview with attorney Jack Graham. Please tune in next week to hear the second half of that interview. And to go to Paul Craig Roberts' website, which was referenced in the interview, it is www.paulcraigroberts.org. And now I want to remind you that we'll be showing the film Weight of Chains 2 as part of our Progressive Movie Night on Wednesday, April 27th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. So again, that's April 27th at 7 p.m. And the movie is Weight of Chains 2, What the Corporate World Doesn't Want You to Know. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
hypocrisy is done.
Turn off their televised illusion. Stand up and look them in the eyes.
Declare your mental liberation. Shake off the dust and claim the prize.
So comrades, come rally. In the last fight, let us face the Internationale. Unites the human race. So comrades, come rally. In the last fight, let us face the Internationale. Unites the human race. We've got something. Something to prove. And everything to gain.
The Building Bridges Special, presented by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And yes, another world is possible. There are alternatives. It's time for a new economy. Two of the nation's leading activists talk about creating jobs, jobs, and more jobs, and creating a new economic model to realize another world is possible. Ed Whitfield is co-founder and co-managing director of the Fund for Democratic Communities, F4DC, a private foundation that aims to promote economic democracy and cooperative economics in the U.S. South. In his work with F4DC, Ed helped initiate the formation of the Southern Grassroots Economies Project and the Southern Reparations Loan Fund. Whitfield has been in the forefront of not just envisioning, but actively building a new economy grounded in justice, democracy, and sustainability.
And Stephen Pitts is associate chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, which focuses on issues of job quality and black workers. In this arena, he has published reports on the economic issues in the black community, initiated a black union leadership school, and shaped projects designed to build solidarity between black and Latino immigrants workers. Currently, a major area of his work involves providing technical assistance to efforts in developing black worker centers around the country.
And Ed Whitfield, Stephen Pitt, it's good to have you with us. I want to begin with what triggered me yesterday was the New York Times Magazine section, actually. Stephen, you focus a lot on public sector jobs. Now, the public sector has long been home of the sorts of jobs that fit people into the middle class and keep them there. But jobs have been shrinking at every level of government. Like we could look at Louisiana with local offices losing tens of thousands of workers, the state government losing 31,000 workers, and the federal government, 1,600 workers. Since the recession hit, private employers have added 5 million jobs, and the government has lost 323,000 jobs. Public employment certainly hasn't recovered. Tens of thousands of layoffs for public sector's employees. And we can look at Wisconsin, which thinned its ranks of government workers thanks to Scott Walker. So as of 2013, where we see still the humongous differentiation between white households. On an average, they are 13 times wealthier than black households. The biggest gap since 1989. The question becomes, really, what is the mechanism for building a new economy, for certainly creating the kind of jobs that for young people to give them a future, to give them hope. These are humongous questions, but I know both of you are up to the occasion. So who wants to begin with this rather mammoth dilemma that's been laid out?
Well, I can start, and I know Steve will have quite a bit to say about this.
Yes, and please feel free, both of you, to have a conversation.
Yeah, from the standpoint of the worker center movements and black labor, I'm kind of place-based and geographically looking at these issues from the southern region of the United States, which is a region that has been devastated by a history and ongoing presence of racism and exploitation. But it was a region that helped to generate much of the existing wealth that dominates the world. I mean, the Industrial Revolution was largely paid for out of the profits of the slave system in the U.S. South. And that's a lesson that I think should not be lost on people who are looking to create a new and better world, that there's certain moral implications in my mind of that origin story. But both my parents were public service workers. My mother, her entire working career was in public education. My father ended up working at the post office of public service jobs. You know, the quality and the stability even of being a school teacher on the Postal Service are being threatened by the ongoing economic crisis and austerity measures and cutbacks and such. One of the things when you talk about, you know, how can we provide for the upcoming generation of young people, one of the ways I like to think about it is that we are in the process of helping to build foundations and structures on which it will be those young people who will themselves have to build rather than us providing it for them. We're not going to leave a gift not that I wouldn't want to, but I don't think that it's actually possible. That one of the ways I like to think about this is that, you know, we're not engaged in how to create a more meaningful world in a world that is sitting waiting for us to do so. The world is dynamic right now. The economic, social, military crises that we see around us are part of the motion that our work has to be integrated into and the things that we have to fight to oppose. So we're looking at changing a world that is itself already changing many times and in many ways for the worse, but it's not static. It's not sitting there waiting for us to come up with some really, really good idea that we can just put in place and see how that works. So in that context, we have, you know, these growing economic financial crises where a lot of people have been convinced by the language of Margaret Thatcher was there is no alternative. And so much of the work I engage in is helping people realize that there are many alternatives and that we have to begin building them in such a way that we capture the imagination and the energy of our communities and the young people in those communities about the possibilities of new ways of approaching things that are centered around meeting human needs and elevating the quality of life rather than being centered around the ever-increasing expansion of extraction and the accumulation of capital. A world that's dominated by capital. The world ought to be dominated by human values for the purpose of expanding the quality of life in our communities and meeting people's needs. And it's not even what it's built for. So much of the work I engage in is trying to help figure out how can we resource sustainable projects that can become models for development and inspire the imagination of communities to realize that we have a different way of building and developing and building an economy rather than the way that we have been told is the necessary way that we know leads to untold misery and hardship.
A couple of things I want to add to that. First, Ed, it's good hearing your voice again. It's good to be in the same space with you. And I wanted to say a couple of things to compliment things that Ed said. It seems to me that the source of the problem is a lack of power. And to me, I start with that kind of proposition, that if you can talk about a deteriorating quality of life for working-class people of all races, starting from the mid-70s, that deterioration was a result of conscious policy choices made by the elite. And so in my mind, the paramount issue is, how do you build power to allow us to have other choices to be made? And so from that line, one thing we're doing is trying to see how we can increase the quality of organizing among Black workers through forming these Black Worker Centers, which should be locally based organizations, membership-based organizations of Black workers, who would basically, where they exist, find ways to change the power dynamics at their place of contention. And so in Los Angeles, people are fighting in areas of construction and trying to ensure that you have both quality jobs in construction and that Black workers in LA can get those jobs. They have, along with doing that work, began to expand and trying to make sure that when the city begins to examine the question of wage theft, they also look at the issue of employment discrimination, which they call the ultimate form of wage theft. But those are actual power battles. In Chicago, people have focused on 1 billion base and the former incarcerated, and have been involved in a statewide coalition trying to eliminate the box on employment applications at the state level. And now they're examining other issues in Chicago. Here I am in Oakland, California. People also looking at the question of the former incarcerated and finding out how we can maximize the space that the former incarcerated have to get good jobs, which includes both looking at and discrimination in hiring, including how do we allocate savings the state has because of the release of folk from prisoners. In Baltimore, people examine the issue of wage theft. And so the issue, I think, really is, how do you kind of drop anchor in a locale, develop membership-based organizations, and from that activity, build power to transform things locally?
I appreciate that, Steve. You know, the question you raised about building power is a central part of the work, I think, that lies in front of us. It's a work that has been going on for quite a while. I don't want to pretend as though we're just now realizing that people have to work and build power. I'm a child of the 60s, and I never have gotten very far away from the discussions I heard growing up about Black power, which just made a lot of sense to me, that we want to build, within Black communities, we want to build the power where people have the capacity of meeting their needs and taking care of and doing things for themselves, and that power has been taken away from us, and it has to be rebuilt. Within the breadth of the country itself, the power has to include the power of drawing in people from the margins to be more decisively part of the discussion of what kind of life do we want, what kind of country do we want, how do we want to be in the world. You know, none of the things that we're talking about in the United States are completely isolated to the United States, because they all stand in relation to foreign policy activities and international activities everywhere. You know, for the Johnson administration, the abridgment of the war on poverty, because more money was needed to pursue the unjust war in Vietnam, is one of the ways that we can see the kind of immediate contention between what goes on here locally and what goes on nationally. But certainly all of it has to be transformed by transformations and the creation of power, and it has to be a power that's based on a real informed and creative response to the existing situation in the world. One of the things I worry about is that much of what power really represents is the capacity of people to act in concert around their own needs and interests. What damages that so much is that we have a situation where the media is able to manipulate what some people understand as reality and has huge numbers of people acting ultimately very, very much against their own self-interest. We have an election process supposed to be democratic, and we're going to end up with a choice between neoliberalism on the one hand and neo-fascism on the other hand. This is something that is largely created out of that kind of alternative reality that is created by the mass media, where, again, money is able to dominate the airwaves in terms of what it is that people hear and see, and how the framing, how the narrative of what the world is really about has been so distorted as to have huge numbers of people functionally acting against their own best interests every day, making choices for things that are wrong. So we have to begin working as we are building power in creating a new narrative, in fighting against the old and corrupt, and in building the new, so that it doesn't seem as though we're talking about imaginary utopias, but we're talking about real actual ways of constructing a different kind of economy. A large part of what has been done with questions of economic reality is to make people think as though the economy is scientific like physics, and these are just the laws of it, and this is just the way it is, as opposed to realizing that the enclosure of nature, the fact that some people took this gigantic ball of dirt that we live on and decided that they just owned huge pieces of it, and ultimately roughly every square inch of the world somebody will claim that they own at this point, and that this enclosure gave right to the extraction and accumulating of all of the value that is created in those areas, and that this accumulation of value ended up creating the tools that allowed a further distortion of how power exists, because those tools amplify the activities and the interests of some people over and above the activities and interests of others. So these are choices that were made at different historical periods, and that have to be undone by people, and it is exactly the exercise of power, Steve correctly points out, that will end up doing that. And again, the question of creating models and examples on the one hand, of changing the narrative, and in helping people understand ways to fight as we engage people in moving past the cynicism of an acceptance of the idea that there is no alternative, to realize that there are many alternatives that they are worth fighting for, and that those fights will not be without sacrifice, but they will be ultimately and absolutely valuable and worth the effort that we have to put into them.
And one reason why I'm excited about what you're doing, Ed, is I think that there are a lot of different strategies that we will have to embark upon to build that power. And so it's my thing is like always let 100 flowers bloom. It's really important if we do that. I think it's also important that people have a sense of what is possible. And so in every kind of arena we fight in, it's important to give people a sense of this is doable. It's all really super important. One thing I would want to mention is I think that people, I'm not clear I would agree that people are really acting against their interests in some ways. I think that people have multiple interests and multiple identities. And the fascinating question is why, at one point in time, one identity takes precedence over others. Okay, so I'm black, I'm old, I'm male, I'm straight, I'm from Chicago, left-handed. A lot of identities. Why does something come to the forefront? I think that in a more nuanced way to look at it, oftentimes really the lack of power and the lack of seeing an alternative is what gives rise to people elevating certain identities and suppressing other ones. I remember when a friend of mine was knocking on the doors in Ohio back in 2004, and he was he's a white guy talking to a white women in Ohio, and she went on and on about Walmart and healthcare and blah, blah, blah. I'm voting for Bush. And all of a sudden, you wondered how you had the first part be on time and the second part be crazy. I think part of the problem is that we haven't been able to give people a sense of what is doable, what's inside their control, and therefore, if people think that some of their concerns cannot be addressed because of the lack of power, they begin to fall back on what they can control. So that's why, again and again, I talk about the importance of power and actually bringing about the transformation we want to see. A second reason to talk about power, I think, is because oftentimes in liberal circles, the source of the problem is not seen to be in power. It's lack of skills in the abstract, lack of wealth in the abstract, lack of behavior in the abstract. I just think that when we start with those issues, we go down a path that would be less positive for our people than starting with a pathway that says power needs to be developed. In the course of that power acquisition or power building, we do a lot of things that's important.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when I say that people are acting against their self-interest sometimes, I remember Randall Robinson recently released a video where he was talking about what happened to Aristide in Haiti. And the kind of vicious military coup that overthrew him, transported him out of the country, and the involvement of the Clintons in that. And one of the statements he made that just really kind of struck me was when he said, you know, those black people in South Carolina who voted for Hillary, they didn't even know this. And I believe they didn't. So I believe that there's a huge way that information is distorted that allow people to think that there are things true about the world that ultimately aren't in the final analysis true. And while there are these complex overlapping identities in terms of who any of us are, sometimes the lack of information about things that are going on that we would care about contributes heavily to us acting against certain kinds of things. And certainly what you're pointing out, Steve, that the lack of recognition of the possibility of being able to address some things caused people to just kind of leave that out of their thinking about how they will engage with each other to do things in the world. So we have to do all of those things. I think we have to make sure that information is believable information is readily available to people. We have to make sure that alternatives are available to people. And we have to engage people in something that helps build up their own sense of their own capacity to change, their own agency, their own capacity to make change. We have to constantly remind people of the various forms in which that takes. We can't lock people into thinking that there's just one way to do this, and either you understand it or you're good at that and or you're out of it. But this acquisition of skills and all that you're talking about is, to me, part of understanding that these man-made tools of development, which include everything from language and education itself as a human creation, as opposed to, you know, silicon dioxide, which is a rough component of sand, that was not a human creation. It was there. We had to figure out what to do with it to make glass out of it. Then the glass is something that we built, and it allows us to make windows that we can see through to keep the weather out. You know, we create these tools, and the tools enhance our power. And so access to the tools that we create, you know, has to be democratized. And we think of that through education, but we have to understand that education is not a value-neutral proposition. There's no generalized education. No one ever can know everything. So you can learn how to plow in a straight line, and that can be your education. You can learn how to ask, do you want to supersize this, and that can be your education. Or you can learn the business model canvas about how it is that you can construct viable business things, and that can be your education. So what we are learning, you know, is connected with certain kind of choices, have to do with how we develop and build power in our communities as well. And a lot of times we see the control of education.
I just want to give Steve Pitts the last minute. Clearly, we need more time for this discussion because we haven't even gotten into the nuts and bolts yet. But the philosophy behind building a new world as possible is of grand significance and importance. Steve Pitts?
The last word in this conversation is to compliment what Ed said, is that in addition to information, I think people need to have vibrant, what we call Black freedom dreams. People have to have a sense of a world beyond the today's world is striving for. And oftentimes they have that sense of these freedom dreams. They're willing to go through brick walls to accomplish it. And so I think that's an important element to our transformation as well. It's been a great conversation. I've enjoyed being on here. And I look forward to continuing it.
I insist. You know, Ed Whitfield, Steve Pitts, they're involved in all kinds of important things. We are just skimming the surface. I know they're going to come back for a full, comprehensive discussion on the work that they're doing because it is critical to our existence. It's critical to fighting for the power, for the working class. And we have been speaking with Ed Whitfield, who is co-founder and co-managing director of the Fund for Democratic Communities. We haven't even begun to talk about, I really want to hear more about the Southern Reparations Loan Fund, and Stephen Pitts, associate chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education, who focuses on issues of job quality and Black workers. So much more to be said. Brothers, I insist that you come back.
Thank you very much.
Talk to you later, man. Happy May Day, everybody.
And workers of the world, indeed, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. And we'll see you again. We build bridges.
With that are you on, boy. With that are you on, no matter what. With that are you on, boy. With that are you on, no matter what.
See, I gotta draw a line. I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffins, man, it's ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been working, I'm a job. dying, I'm ready. I'm with the Apu in Oaxaca and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like Palestinian children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip hop, for the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers, and lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organized, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver. I'm with Evo Morales, man, he running Bolivia. Distribution of the land so we can all live bigger. I'm with Hugo and Fidel, Grandmaster and Melly Mel. I'm with the Panthers up in Queens, justice for Sean Bell. I'm with Camacho Negron, I'm with Ojeda Rios. Freedom for Oscar López, time to get in the field. I'm with a Blue Jamal, I'm with a Sada Shakur. I'm with the compas in the market, he getting a penny more.
Has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
lots of us grew up with the idea that out gay life on the street, extravagant, happy, wonderful gay life is a very recent invention. We find it hard to believe that glorious creatures like Stella were around a long time ago. People often use the phrase, gosh, the world has really changed. And that's a phrase that I think should be banned. The world doesn't just change. All the changes that we've seen in this country are changes that we made happen.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Russian activists arrested where neo-Nazis march free. U.S. Methodist ministers defy marriage policy ahead of equality vote, and Stella steals the show at Brighton. Those stories and more this week, because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending May 7th, 2016.
Russian police officers welcomed a contingent of neo-Nazis to this week's annual St. Petersburg Labor Day parade. 19 out LGBT people, on the other hand, were violently arrested for trying to march in the May 3rd parade under their own banner. The city's legislative assembly allowed Slavic Power Northwest to march under the banner for the unity of Slavs and the white race. There were no incidents. The LGBT rights group Coming Out was given the okay to march as long as participants didn't display rainbow flags or other self-identifying material for the safety of other marchers. Doing so would violate the nation's so-called gay propaganda law, which, with the full support of President Vladimir Putin, bans any public support for LGBT rights whenever and wherever minors could be present. Coming Out proudly marched under its own banner anyway, which prompted the arrests. Video shot on the scene shows activists being roughed up and dragged to police vans. Charges facing 19 of them range from violating the gay propaganda law to resisting arrest and hooliganism. One young woman who requested anonymity told reporters that it's disgusting that a neo-Nazi group, who if they had their way would want us put in camps or something, is allowed to march freely. We know which side the police are with now.
Elsewhere, a North Carolina pastor and bishop have risked their careers by violating United Methodist Church law and officiating the marriage of a gay couple. Retired Bishop Melvin Talbert co-officiated with Reverend Val Rosenquist at the wedding of Jim Wilborn and John Romano at First United Methodist Church in Charlotte. Several other faith leaders were present to lend their support. According to the UMC group Reconciling Ministries Network, the ceremony could jeopardize the pastoral credentials of Reverend Rosenquist. Current church policy forbids clergy from presiding at the weddings of same-gender couples and warns that no ceremony can take place in a UMC sanctuary. The pastor and bishop could each be reprimanded or even defrocked. Other Methodist clergy who've officiated marriages of same-gender couples have been similarly disciplined. Bishop Talbert, who was arrested with Martin Luther King Jr. in the Atlanta sit-ins in 1960, called the wedding an equal rights protest, telling BuzzFeed that it was an act of civil disobedience. The only difference is we are giving it another name and calling it biblical obedience. With about 7 million members, the United Methodist Church is America's largest mainline Protestant Christian denomination. Its general conference is scheduled to begin in Portland, Oregon on May 10th. Delegates rejected attempts in 2008 and again in 2012 to repeal the church's ban on clergy officiating at the weddings of same-gender couples. Reconciling Ministries Network and other pro-equality advocates hope the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 marriage equality ruling will make this year's third effort the charm.
In this week's developments involving North Carolina and its offensively discriminatory HB2, the U.S. Department of Justice officially warned the Tar Heel state's dominant Republican Party that they stand to lose millions of federal dollars unless the law is repealed. HB2 bans local governments from protecting LGBT people from discrimination or from even passing a minimum wage that surpasses the state standard. HB2 is best known, however, as a bathroom bill, because it also requires trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities based on their birth gender, not the gender with which they identify. U.S. Deputy Assistant Attorney General Vinita Gupta issued separate letters to state officials and to North Carolina's public university system this week, warning that HB 2 conflicts with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. Both documents ban sex discrimination, which courts and the Obama administration have determined to include discrimination based on gender identity. The letter told state officials to begin a repeal process by Monday, May 9th. North Carolina and its public colleges could lose millions of dollars in federal aid if the law isn't overturned. House Speaker Tim Moore told reporters on May 5th that the Justice Department demands were unreasonable and politically motivated.
This fight's about a duly passed law for the state of North Carolina and about the overreach of the Obama Justice Department. We will take no action by Monday. That deadline will come and go. You know, we don't ever want to lose any money, but we're not going to get bullied by the Obama administration to take action prior to Monday's date. That's not how this works.
Vastly outnumbered minority Democrats in the legislature reminded anyone who would listen that HB 2 was debated, passed, and signed into law in one single day in late March. Governor Pat McCrory, who steadfastly defended the law, told Raleigh TV station WNCN late this week that the state would comply with the federal edict. However, he has no power to force lawmakers to take action.
The last U.S. state adoptions ban finally fell this week. Mississippi officials had until May 3rd to file an appeal of a federal court ruling that found the state law banning same-gender couples from adopting children to be unconstitutional. Ruling that the Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling included adoption rights, U.S. District Court Judge Daniel P. Jordan III issued a preliminary injunction earlier this year that blocked the Mississippi Department of Human Services from enforcing the ban. State officials' failure to continue to defend the law means that it's effectively dead.
Backlash against Mississippi's so-called religious freedom law continues. HB 1523, passed by the overwhelming Republican majority in the state legislature and proudly signed by Governor Phil Bryant, allows employees in both the private and public sectors to refuse service to anyone they don't like based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. LGBT people are the less than subtle targets. A growing number of business leaders and entertainers have condemned the law. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside the governor's mansion in Jackson on May 2nd to demand repeal. Representatives from the Human Rights Campaign, the NAACP, the ACLU of Mississippi, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and Planned Parenthood joined in.
The Kansas State Legislature adjourned on May 2nd without taking any action on two anti-transgender bathroom bills that would have rewarded students who reported violations of the law. The bills barred trans students in public schools, including state colleges and universities, from using the sex-segregated facilities that correspond with their gender identity, including restrooms, showers, and locker rooms. The bills offered $2,500 in damages to any aggrieved student who witnessed a trans student using the prohibited facilities.
What critics call the nation's most terrifying anti-trans ordinance was passed unanimously in late April by the Oxford, Alabama City Council and then repealed by a vote of 3-2 just a few days later. The ordinance imposed a fine of $500 and up to 6 months in jail for the misdemeanor crime of using a public restroom that didn't match the gender listed on a person's birth certificate. Opponents led by the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU, which specifically threatened a lawsuit, told the city council on May 4th that the ordinance also threatened the loss of substantial federal funding because it violated national anti-discrimination laws. Satisfied SPLC staff attorney Shaneer Ezzi told reporters that nobody should be criminalized for simply using the restroom. In a related story, rabidly homophobic Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore has been suspended and faces possible removal from office. A state commission on May 6th charged him with 6 counts of ethics violations surrounding his obstructive actions against marriage equality following the Supreme Court's June 2015 ruling. He claimed that the ruling didn't apply in his state and ordered Alabama probate judges not to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples.
And finally, National political correspondent David Weigel noted in the May 3rd edition of the Washington Post that transgender people won a somewhat queer electoral victory this week. Far-right Republican presidential wannabe Senator Ted Cruz of Texas tried to make his last stand in the Indiana state primary a referendum on trans rights. He warned about predatory men invading women's and girls' bathrooms and railed up and down the state against rival Donald Trump for not joining his crusade. Cruz then lost Indiana in a landslide and ceded the Republican nomination to Trump. Marla Kiesling of the National Center for Transgender Equality said that Senator Cruz's desperate attempt at using transgender people to scare people and drum up support clearly didn't work. Hopefully, politicians will leave us out of their rhetoric unless they have something constructive to say. That's News Wrap for the week ending May 7th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jason Proctor.
And I'm John Dyer V.
The world premiere of British queer arts activist Neil Bartlett's newest work is bound to be one of the biggest attractions at this year's Brighton Fringe Festival. Bartlett first used the story of the gender-fluid 19th-century performer Stella in a piece for a 1983 festival, but this time Stella takes center stage. Radio Reverb's Out in Brighton host Kathy Caton shared her exclusive interview with the OBE recipient writer-director.
She's only a bird in a gilded cage, a beautiful sight to see. You may think she's happy and free from care. She's not, though she seems to be.
Neil, why Stella and why this key figure who's at the heart of the piece?
Stella's been a fixture and fitting in my life for a very long time. I first discovered Stella and her story way back in 1983, boys and girls. There was a fantastic thing in London called September in the Pink. And September in the Pink was the first London-wide lesbian and gay arts festival. There had been other queer arts festivals, but not one that stretched right across London, which was a big controversial thing back in the day in 1983. There were angry letters from the Evening Standard and so on and so on. And I was one of the people who helped organise the festival. And I also created my own piece of work for the festival. And it was a piece about queer history. It had three episodes, three acts, if you like. The first was about gay men's lives in London in the 18th century, and the third piece was about our current lives. The middle section was about the 19th century, and while I was researching the piece, and also while I was writing my first book, which was a queer history book, I discovered this extraordinary story of Stella, a.k.a. Ernest Bolton. And I think because lots of us grew up with the idea that out gay life, gay life on the street, proud gay life, extravagant, happy, wonderful gay life is a very recent invention. We find it hard to believe that glorious creatures like Stella were around a long time ago. So, Stella's story. To save any time or trouble, I'll just call her she. I always think of Stella as she. Stella's born in 1848, respectable lower middle class circumstances, born in Tottenham, North London. Her family sent her to work in a bank, and that doesn't really work out because already by the time she's 18, 19, Stella and her friends are running around the West End of London, sometimes dressed in what I would call high femme, high queen style, lots of makeup, very tight trousers, very loud colours, very low-cut shirt collars, and hanging around the streets, generally causing trouble in the fashionable West End, Piccadilly especially, and the Strand. Sometimes, even worse, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Stella and her friends would go out dressed as ladies,
What they meant by ladies exactly varies depending on where they were. If they were on the Strand, Piccadilly, then they were ladies in the sense of sex workers. They were out to pick up men and either get bought dinner or something slightly more graphic. If they were on the other side of Piccadilly, Burlington Arcade, they were masquerading as middle-class ladies with a capital L. And Stella and her friends could pass. In other words, they could choose whether to walk down the street as women or if they wanted to reveal themselves as being what we would call queens, what they would call sodomites or Marianne's, they could do that. Then 1869 all goes a bit pear-shaped. She goes out with her friend Fanny to the Strand Theatre, and at the end of the evening they decide they need to titivate slightly, so they go into the ladies' loo to repair their makeup. And they get rumbled, and outside the theatre, they're arrested. Very shortly afterwards, they're both in the dock at the Old Bailey, and they're on front page of every national newspaper in the country. Being outed as a cross-dressing sodomite in 1869 was a dangerous thing. That was a disaster. Fortunately, she had a brilliant defence lawyer who, whether by luck or good judgment, hit on a brilliant argument. The charge was conspiracy to commit a felony, which was code for being a bugger, being a sodomite. And their defence counsel brilliantly argued, if you were a sodomite, surely the last thing in the world you would do would be to run up and down the Strand wearing cherry silk, lots of slap, a wig, false tits, high heels, etc., because that would draw attention to the fact that you were a queen. And the jury, bless them, fell for it. And so Stella was acquitted. She fainted dramatically, possibly deliberately, I think, at the moment the not guilty verdict was declared. In a way, that's the least interesting part of her extraordinary story. What then happens is what really, I think, makes her a game changer in our sense of ourselves as queer people. What would you do if you'd been outed as a cross-dressing sodomite and you were on the front page? Surely you would tone down your act. Surely you would disappear. Not a bit of it. She changes her name, goes to America, and a few months later is having a rather successful career as a bit part actress and drag queen on Broadway, if you please. She goes to New York and does rather well for someone of really very little talent. She had apparently a pretty voice, a fantastic wardrobe, and she looked gorgeous. Of course, the American career couldn't last forever. The publicity that she generated by being so notorious began to fade, and also she began to lose her looks. Does she give up? No, she doesn't. She comes back to this country. She changes her name once again, and she tours in the absolute fag end of British music hall and vaudeville for another 26 years. That's extraordinary. You know, to be a flamboyant queen when you're young and gorgeous is one thing. 25 years later, when you're playing second-rate gigs on the Isle of Man or in the smallest theatre in town in Scunthorpe or wherever else she was reduced to touring, for me, that's real heroism. Stella died in 1904. We know she was living in Somerstown, and you don't end up in rented accommodation in Somerstown if life is going well. And she died in the London hospital. She must have died as he, as Ernest Bolton. It's very difficult to go into a hospital now as anything except your birth gender. That's a difficult thing to achieve. And in 1904, that was an impossible thing to do. So she must have made that last journey to the hospital as Ernest, not as Stella.
My name's Kathy Caton, and I'm talking to the award-winning playwright, director and performer, Neil Bartlett. At the moment, in terms of the fight for trans visibility, the growth of queer and life beyond binary, where do you think Stella would have identified?
Well, Stella, of course, lived before hormones and before gender reassignment surgery. There is a completely uncorroborated story which came from her mother's evidence in the trial at the Old Bailey that Stella liked to dress up as a little girl when he was a little boy. We don't know if that's true. And some people have seized on that and said, you see, Stella was trans. The facts are that when she was working in the bank, I think she would have passed as a normal, in inverted commas, young man. When she was queening around the West End in effeminate male dress, she would have self-identified probably as a Marianne, which was the word used in London more often than the word queen, for someone who was on the borderline between being an out-and-out sodomite and a sex worker. Possibly she would have called herself a sodomite. When she was in drag, sometimes she appeared as a drag queen. She toured in amateur and professional theatricals, and sometimes the playbills and the reviews say the marvellous female impersonator Mr. Ernest Bolton as Stella, and sometimes they say the marvellous Stella Clinton. And the reason why they use the surname Clinton is Stella had a boyfriend, Arthur Pelham Clinton, in fact Lord Arthur Pelham Clinton, her boyfriend, dear reader, was a Tory MP. And Arthur and Stella appear together on the stage and always in little dramatic skits where Arthur would play the straight man, the man, and Stella would play the lady. So sometimes a lady, sometimes a drag queen, sometimes a lady with a capital L, sometimes with a small L. When she appeared in the dock at the Old Bailey, possibly her greatest triumph of impersonation, she grew a moustache to convince people presumably that she was a real man. So, as you can see, I'm dancing right round your question and refusing to say, was Stella trans in the modern sense of the word, of someone who fully identifies as leaving behind one gender and becoming another? We don't know. All we do know is she travelled through many gender identities, sometimes in the course of a single day. And of course, I'm an artist. I'm not in the business of saying we really need to categorise this historical figure, because that will prove what. I think we need to revel in the imaginative possibilities that this glimpse of history might give us. Of course, I'm thrilled that the conversation has moved on from where it was when I first put Stella on the stage back in 1983. There seem to be so many more possibilities about how we as queer people can live. The question for me is, how do you live? How do you want to walk down the street?
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
When you talk about early 80s, height of Section 28, definite lesbian and gay identities, fighting. And you've been active in the queer arts world for some years.
Yeah, don't be shy.
For decades.
I've been making my living as an out queer artist since 1982, and I'm really happy about that.
And the huge amount that we have travelled in that time. How does it feel to, when you look back on that journey from the early 80s to where we stand now?
Well, it feels very tiring, obviously. I hope that where we've got to always encourages us to ask for more. I think we're living in wonderful times and also in very dangerous times. I think there is a real and present danger that we're being sold the idea that gay history is over in this country. We've now arrived at diversity, tolerance, acceptance, and we can all just relax and enjoy our little gay lives and everybody loves us. And I think that's horseshit. It certainly is true that life is a lot safer than it used to be. You know, my partner and I, he's just had knee replacement surgery, so he has to lean on my arm when we're walking down the street. And he's been up and about for 2 months now. So we've been walking arm in arm down lots of streets in Brighton and in Worthing and in all different parts of London. We haven't had any trouble. Cut back to 1983, which was just before he and I met. if you were out courting arm in arm in 1983 through to for the next decade, you were going to get shouted at, spat at, or punched, you know. So I'm really glad that that has changed. But for me, as a queer man of that generation, the real demands that we were making, oh, I'm going to sound very old-fashioned now. Do I care? For me, gay liberation and feminism were the same thing. I learnt how to fight for my freedom from one, women, and two, other queens. And where is that struggle in this country? Do you know any women? Oh, it's fantastic. You know, really, feminism is over because we've got everything we ever wanted. And what about all the other appalling forms of inequality and prejudice which are stifling this country? And so the larger demands of gay liberation, which were not, can you leave me in peace? I just want to go to the gym, the disco, and then to bed with my boyfriend. But can you not acknowledge that queer lives are a glimpse of the world running differently? I will now press the button to hear the sound effect, which is Neil climbing down off his soapbox. And one more thing while I'm up on my box. People often use the phrase, gosh, the world has really changed in the last few decades. And that's a phrase that I think should be banned. The world doesn't just change, the world gets changed. We didn't get to this place because someone turned round and said, hey, queer people, would it be nice for you if we stopped discriminating against you? All the changes that we've seen in this country from top to bottom are changes that we made happen. We've made them happen incredibly fast and in a way that will be really difficult to unpick in the future. We're really good at fighting for change, and I want us to use what we've learned about how to do that to go further.
We'd like to thank Kathy Caton for sharing her exclusive Out in Brighton interview with the brilliant Neil Bartlett. The month-long Brighton Fringe Festival starts this week, and Stella plays Friday and Saturday, May 27th and 28th, at the Theatre Royal Brighton. You can find the playwright online at Neil, that's Neil-Bartlett.com. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jason Proctor, John Dyer V, and Kathy Caton contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Harry Anthony and the Tom Robinson Band performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and to you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our must-have LGBT History from Outlaws to In-Laws CD, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, KBRP Bisbee, Arizona, WBCR Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Okay, here's an understatement. Capitalism has transformed our world. Yes, the transformation has taken place at the level of production, labor, commodities, and finance, but also transformed has been how we think, how we understand the world, and what we believe is natural and desirable. Adam Smith, who lived from 1723 to 1790, is credited with articulating capitalism's key elements. But an ambitious documentary series has taken the time to look at what Adam Smith actually wrote, the ideas he had that have in many cases been turned and twisted to serve politically conservative agendas. Putting Adam Smith's ideas under a microscope is just one task undertaken by the makers of a six-part film series called Capitalism, which also examines the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, Karl Marx, Friedrich Hayek, David Ricardo, and many others. It does so by featuring some of the world's most prominent and, in many cases, radical historians, economists, anthropologists, and social critics, including Noam Chomsky, David Graeber, Thomas Piketty, Yanis Varoufakis, and David Harvey. Today we focus on one of the six episodes, an eye-opening investigation into what's remembered and misunderstood about Adam Smith's insights into capitalism and how it operates. And we offer you the full six-part series, well over 5 hours in length, on DVD for a pledge of $240 to listener-sponsored KPFA, a pledge that you can pay in 12 monthly installments of $20. $20 per month gets you this six-part, 320-minute series, Capitalism. The phone number to call anytime this hour is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. KPFA. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org. Let's turn now to excerpts from the episode of the series Capitalism called The Wealth of Nations, A New Gospel.
Le capitalisme engendre une dynamique permanente d'accumulation, de crise et d'innovation.
I believe that open markets and free enterprise are the best imaginable force for improving human wealth and happiness.
Je pense que les forces sociales et politiques sont les forces centrales dans la dynamique du capitalisme.
Did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism?
Is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed?
How would Smith see the economic world around us?
I think Keynes would have said the problem is the hole in the economy.
Hayek really wrote The Road to Serfdom as a warning.
You always have to be careful with Marx about the one-liners. You know.
Polanyi, for me, was an intellectual earthquake.
I mean, if I had to stereotype Ricardo, I would say he would look like George Soros.
Si vous retournez chez Adam Smith, Marx, Schumpeter, vous avez des embryons de mécanismes vous permettant de comprendre la crise actuelle.
We were told that capitalism is the product of big thinkers and big ideas. But is it true? How did ideas shape our lives? What is their relation to reality? Can they help us understand today's economic crisis, let alone the future of capitalism?
Want any of his unpolished, unfinished manuscripts to survive him. And he laid down in his will that his two executors were to burn these papers after his death. But that wasn't enough. And really, almost days before his death, he summoned his executors and said, I want you to do it now. And they sat there in front of the fire and systematically burned all his unpublished manuscripts. What has survived was simply two highly polished works, his great theory of moral sentiments and his even greater Wealth of Nations.
The Wealth of Nations, which survived the fire, has been presented over the centuries as the founding book of the free market system. Many of Adam Smith's notes were destroyed in the fire, leaving us with only this book and the interpretations of those who have used it to promote the very narrow view of the market as a science. It's hard to imagine how this primitive smelter in Calcutta, India, has anything to do with the Wealth of Nations. But work here is following the first principle of Adam Smith's book, division of labor, a principle which, after Smith's death, has been elevated to a scientific law.
One of the characteristics of the society you know that I know is the intense degree of specialization which takes place in employments, ranging from the most skilled and complicated employments to the most simple.
To take an example, the trade of a pin maker could perhaps, with his utmost industry, make one pin a day. But in the way this business is now being carried on, one draws out the wire, another straightens it, another cuts it, a fourth points it. I have seen a small manufactory of this kind where 10 men make among themselves 12 pounds of pins a day. Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations.
So he comes to the conclusion that progress, economic progress, has got everything to do with the division of labor.
No wonder the division of labor has been treated as the equivalent of a Newtonian law. After all, it has been the engine of wealth creation used in the manufacture of almost every product we know. from a sophisticated iPad to a single pencil. For Smith's followers, the division of labor has become a pillar of the free market economy.
To enable millions of people to cooperate peacefully together, we need to understand how it is that a free market works. I know no better way to bring this out than by a very simple example called I the Pencil. This is the only prop I have for this TV show. As you can see, it's a plain yellow pencil. There's nobody in the world who knows how to make a pencil. Now, that seems like a silly thing to say. This is just the most obvious thing. It's only a piece of wood with something black in the middle and the little red tip at the end. What do you mean nobody knows how to make a pencil? Well, suppose you were to start to set out to make a pencil. First of all, you have to get some wood, don't you? Where do you get the wood? You have to go to the Pacific Northwest, probably, and cut down some trees. How do you cut down some trees? You have to have some saws to cut it with. Where do you get the saws? You have to have some steel. Where do you get the steel? You have to have a steel mill. In order to have the steel mill, you have to get the iron ore, and you can add all the rest. But that's only the beginning. This black stuff in the middle that we call lead isn't lead. It's graphite, I think. I'm not absolutely sure. And I am told it comes from some mines in South America. Now, this little red tip at the top, that's rubber. Where's it come from? Well, the major source of natural rubber is Malaya. But the miracle of this pencil isn't that nobody knows how to make it. The miracle of the pencil is, how did it get made? What is it that has enabled this little elementary transaction to take place? Now, how is that brought about? Is there some commissar sitting in some central office who is sending out orders to these people in Malaya, to these people in South America, to the people in Washington? How is it that they are led to cooperate with one another? These thousands of people who have been led to engage in this simple transaction, not one of them has been forced to do it. Nobody has had a gun to his head. They've all done it. Why? Because each one of them thinks he's better off in this transaction.
This is the moral dilemma at the heart of the Wealth of Nations. The economic logic of division of labor versus the human cost to achieve it. But was Adam Smith blind to this dilemma?
Adam Smith is very rarely read. He's worshipped, but not read. I mean, everyone who went to college learned the first paragraph of Wealth of Nations.
The greatest improvements in the productive power of labor and the greater part of the skill, dexterity, and judgment seem to have been the effects for the division of labor. Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations.
Not very many people got to page 400, in which he points out that the division of labor is monstrous.
In the progress of the division of labor, a great body of people comes to be confined to a few very simple operations. The worker has no occasion to exert his understanding. Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations.
It turns people into creatures as stupid and ignorant as a person can possibly be. A person just becomes a machine. That's a terrible attack on fundamental human rights. And therefore, he says, in any civilized society, the government is going to have to intervene to prevent division of labor. How many people get that far?
For centuries, economists and politicians ignored Adam Smith's own recognition of the moral dilemma at the heart of division of labor. Self-interest, his second most quoted principle, suffered a similar fate.
Please welcome the Nobel laureate in economics, Milton Friedman, right? Let's share with the people at home just one of the statements of Adam Smith that you refer to in your book, which, of course, when I want it, I'm not going to be able to... Oh, it's on page two. All right, thank you. By pursuing his own interest, that is to say, his meaning the person engaged in free enterprise, Adam Smith says, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectively than when he really intends to promote it.
Adam Smith considered self-interest as the driving force of the economy. But do we know what he actually meant by it? To find out, we must first explore the times in which he lived.
So you know, Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations. Self-interest and greed is good, and the invisible hand and free enterprise and free markets, etc. All that kind of, he's the father of capitalism. But it turns out, there's another Adam Smith. How many people here have read The Theory of Moral Sentiments? And according to Adam Smith, it was his important book. It was his magnum opus. In some ways, that was his magnum opus, and The Wealth of Nations paid the bills. He never imagined capitalism that he wrote about in The Wealth of Nations could actually succeed without the moral underpinnings, the moral, what he called sentiments. We would call them virtues. Without the virtues of a society and virtues of individuals, that would actually create the base of a healthy capitalism. Well, all you could do is look here and see that The Wealth of Nations and A Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith 1, Adam Smith 2, have been disconnected.
When you see around the globe the maldistribution of wealth, the desperate plight of millions of people in underdeveloped countries, when you see so few haves and so many have-nots, when you see the greed and the concentration of power within, did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism?
Tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed? You think Russia doesn't run on greed? You think China doesn't run on greed? What is greed? Of course, none of us are greedy. It's only the other fellow who's greedy. The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Of course, we are all, to an extent, selfish. Some people more, some people less. But we also have many other motivations. I mean, we have solidarity, we have loyalty, we have sympathy. You know, I mean, all these motivations are real. And we really, need to design a system that exploits all these complex human motivations. Because if you begin to assume that everyone is selfish, everyone's, you know, only out to promote his or her own self-interest, and then you have to suspect everyone, you have to monitor everyone all the time, and the system will actually grind to a halt.
The great achievements of civilization have not come from government bureaus. Einstein didn't construct his theory under order from a bureaucrat. Henry Ford didn't revolutionize the automobile industry that way.
But Henry Ford is a perfect example that self-interest is far more complex than greed or individualism. In 1914, he single-handedly almost doubled the salaries of his workers and reduced their working hours from 9 to 8 hours a day. Increasing their salaries, he claimed, will turn workers into consumers. It will help to expand the economy and his car sales. He dreamed that every worker could one day own a Ford car. So how did Adam Smith's nuanced concept of self-interest become transformed over more than 200 years into a global economic system driven by greed? It begins with the separation of Adam Smith 1 from Adam Smith 2 and the transformation of the Wealth of Nations into a science.
Excerpts, audio excerpts from a sprawling documentary series called Capitalism. 6 parts. Each part is about 50 minutes long. It adds up to 5 hours plus of information and insight about capitalism. And it is a available on DVD to you for a pledge of $20 a month spread over 12 months, a $240 pledge to this listener-sponsored radio station, KPFA, gets you as a thank you gift the Capitalism six-part documentary series. And it is ambitious, it's accessible, and the phone number is also very easy. It's 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. And you can donate online at kpfa.org. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored KPFA radio. And for a $20 a month, 12-month pledge to KPFA, you get this full series on DVD, this six-part, 320-minute documentary film series. It's an amazing effort. And what it does is it goes through the major ideas around capitalism, the way capitalism has been conceptualized and thought about and worked on and tinkered with over centuries, beginning with Adam Smith. And each episode covers a certain time period or a certain debate or a certain thinker. You get all six parts, and each one stands alone. Like, you can just sit down and watch the first episode, which I think is 53 minutes, and it's like a self-contained documentary film. But no, there's actually six more. There are five more parts to this six-part series. And 320 minutes of all this information brought to you by thinkers like Noam Chomsky and Thomas Piketty, who the French thinker who you might know wrote a world-famous book now on inequality. Yanis Varoufakis, David Graeber, the anarchist anthropologist who's been on Against the Grain, and many others are featured in this film series, which pairs insights and interviews, insights from and interviews with thinkers with archival footage. There are splendid production values, and this six-part documentary series about the history of ideas that have shaped the capitalist world and the social and political forces that have shaped that world is yours as a thank you gift for a $20 a month, 12-month pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. The six episodes are Episode 1, Adam Smith, The Birth of the Free Market. Episode 2, which we're drawing on today, The Wealth of Nations, a book by Adam Smith, A New Gospel. Episode 3, David Ricardo and Thomas Malthus, Did You Say Freedom? Episode 4, What If Marx Was Right? Episode 5, Keynes, John Maynard Keynes versus Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, A Fake Debate. And episode 6 is about Karl Polanyi, who sought to reintegrate society and economy. And the praise for this film series has been abundant. One reviewer said, a captivating epic, a major contribution to economic and social reflection. Another journal said, brings clarity to confusion, makes complexities accessible, and provides a clear narrative of a system, capitalist system, that seems opaque to most people. And one other reviewer said, offers a fresh perspective of the events and ideas that set the stage for free markets. Carefully researched and comprehensive, highly recommended. All of this is yours. This, not one part, not three part, but six part, not 1 hour, but more than 5 hour documentary series called Capitalism, with all these really interesting episodes. The phone number again, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, which translates as 1-800-HEY-KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And of course, when thinkers are on, such as Piketty speaking in French. There are obviously subtitles in this documentary series. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. And let's go back now to more excerpts, more audio excerpts from the second episode of this series, Capitalism. Again, the episode title is called The Wealth of Nations, A New Gospel.
The doctrine of self-interest was the economic equivalent to the law of gravity. It ensured equilibrium. Everyone was free to pursue their self-interests in markets. You would get an equilibrium, optimal equilibrium, which was equivalent to the equilibrium of natural bodies when they were free to move as well. So I think the analogy with physics was very, very strong. What they ignored completely was how human beings actually behave. Sociology and psychology have been very well aware that a lot of behavior is what that, you know, what economists would call irrational. But in fact, I don't think that that is the right way of describing it. I think it's human.
Self-interest had been enshrined as a law of physics in the 19th century. In the first part of the 20th century, it evolved in the U.S. into a moral philosophy.
I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others. That, in fact, makes man a sacrificial animal. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself. Now, what can be more important than happiness? But happiness does not mean simply momentary pleasures or any kind of mindless self-indulgence. Happiness means a profound, guiltless, rational feeling of self-esteem and of pride in one's own achievement.
Join me in welcoming Paul Ryan.
In the 21st century, Ayn Rand's philosophy of self-interest became part of a political campaign.
I grew up reading Ayn Rand, and it taught me quite a bit about who I am and what my value systems are and what my beliefs are.
The issue that is under assault, the attack on democratic capitalism, on individualism and freedom in America, is an attack on the moral foundation of America. And Ayn Rand, more than anyone else, did a fantastic job of explaining the morality of capitalism, the morality of individualism.
Our rights come from nature and God, not from government.
This kind of approach has been so destructive, especially in the last 20, 30 years. We have come to almost glorify self-interest. I mean, we have come to believe that all the other motivations, all the other emotions, all the other moral values, they are somehow secondary. They are somehow for stupid people. They are somehow for kind of lower beings. That has created this system where people are actually expected to be ignorant of the broader social framework. They are encouraged actually just to look after their own interests, and we are living the consequences today.
There are two words which over the centuries immortalized Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations. They've become shorthand for global economic activities, transforming self-interest into a magical mechanism, an engine for a global economic system. The invisible hand has long been a staple of any economics course.
Or offer something better.
Yet Adam Smith never wrote it in this context.
Adam Smith was concerned that if there was free movement of capital and free import of goods, he said England will suffer. because British capitalists will invest abroad, and they'll import from abroad, and that'll harm the English economy. And Adam Smith then gave an argument, not a very good argument, but his argument was that English investors will prefer to invest in England because of what some called a home bias. They'll have a preference for investing close by, and therefore, as if by an invisible hand, England will be saved from the menace of free capital movement and the free import. That's invisible hand. What's that got to do with the Cato Institute or the modern enthusiasm about free capital flow and having U.S. corporations invest in China so they can send stuff back here to sell cheap, exploiting Chinese workers? That's not Adam Smith.
Committee will please come to order. Today is our fourth hearing into the ongoing financial crisis.
In 2009, in the wake of the financial collapse, Alan Greenspan, the former head of America's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, was invited back to Washington as the man who, more than others, promoted deregulation in the name of the invisible hand.
Today in this hearing, Dr. Greenspan, I want to start with you. You have been a staunch advocate for letting markets regulate themselves. And my question for you is simple. Were you wrong?
I found a flaw.
You found a flaw
in the model that defines how the world works, so to speak.
In other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right. Precisely.
No, that's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I had been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well.
Which model was he referring to? Alan Greenspan's intellectual career began with Ayn Rand. He was among her disciples, an enthusiastic believer in her theory of the supremacy of rationality.
It is only since the Industrial Revolution, the birth of a free society, the society of capitalism, that there was a new class of men, which is the free producers of material goods, the businessmen, the industrialists. That is the man who lives by means of reason. That is the man who, in his psycho-epistemology, is not guided by his immediate perceptions nor by his emotions, but by logic, by his concepts, by reason. That is the man whom I call the producer.
When Alan Greenspan was nominated years later by then-President Gerald Ford to head his Council of Economic Advisers, Greenspan paid tribute to his old master and invited her to meet the president. Three years before the financial meltdown, Alan Greenspan visited Kirkcaldy, Adam Smith's birthplace, in commemoration of the great thinker. One could hardly imagine, Greenspan said, that today's awesome array of international transactions would produce the relative economic stability that we experience daily if they were not led by some international version of Smith's invisible hand.
In recent decades, a vast risk management and pricing system has evolved, combining the best insights of mathematicians and finance experts. The whole intellectual edifice, however, collapsed in the summer of last year.
And so, with magical and mystical words like invisible hand, words which were taken out of context, the intellectual structure of free market was created.
Excerpts from an amazing series. It's a documentary film series, 6 parts, 6 episodes, more than 5 hours for you. It's called Capitalism. It's about capitalism. It's about ideas. It's about practice. It's about a system that has transformed the world politically, socially, environmentally, economically. And it is yours as a thank you gift to KPFA. If you want to give to KPFA in the amount of, if you can give to KPFA, in the amount of $20 per month over the next 12 months. It comes out to $240 if you want to pay it all at once. But $20 a month, I mean, that's not a bad deal for more than 5 hours of great insight into and information about this system that we all live under, that dominates our lives, that dominates an increasingly large number of lives around the world. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We'll return to more from this film series called Capitalism. But I want to let you know that we've been given a match which is operative for the next, let's see, 21 minutes, and I think we can do it. We made the match that we gave out yesterday, by the way, of $1,000. Today's match, and thank you so much to everybody who called and made that possible, today we've been given a match of $850 from Rafi and Monica in Fresno, California. It's lovely to hear from people in Fresno and Against the Grain and KPFA, our broadcast on KFCF in Fresno. Rafi and Monica in Fresno have come up with $850, and they will double your money. It's a conditional pledge. It's a pledge made on condition that we can raise the equivalent amount from all the rest of you out there in the next now 20 minutes and 40 seconds. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you pledge securely online at kpfa.org, it will also count toward that match of $850. In fact, I see that we've already gotten a pledge in the amount of $250 from someone in Menlo Park. So thank you so much to that pledger. It's very simple and easy to pledge online, but it's also easy, and it only takes a few minutes, to call 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and to give to something that you care about and that you want to see succeed and you want to see survive and you want around for the next day and several months and several years, so that you and other people can benefit from this kind of information. I want to say that Capitalism, this six-part, five-hour-plus documentary series that is yours for a $20 a month, 12-month pledge, is not available online or at any store. It's not available for sale to individuals. It is available for purchase by institutions at the hefty price of $498, right? So if you're an institution, you can purchase this on DVD for the retail price of $498. But we are making it available to folks, to you, for a pledge of $240, a pledge you can pay in 12 monthly installments of $20. So if you're tempted to go try and shop online for this documentary series, it's simply not available for whatever reasons the producers or distributors have, but you can do it now, and you can do it in a tax-deductible way as a contribution to something that perhaps you care a whole lot about, and your dollars are doubled for the next 18 and a half minutes. $850 from Rafi and Monica. Every dollar you give is doubled. Some of the other reviews of Capitalism, the six-part series, Masterly is going to revolutionize our vision of the economic world. Should Not Be Missed combines highly educational explanations of concepts, economic history, and contemporary life to create a series of documentaries, each of which is difficult to stop watching. 10 Stars, a truly captivating series that delves into history, philosophy, investigates four corners of the planet, and stimulates the viewer with a re-examination of the basic concepts that define our lives. And again, you get not one episode, but six 50-plus minute episodes as part of this deluxe box set, Capitalism, a six-part series. You get an episode called Adam Smith, The Birth of the Free Market. You get an episode called The Wealth of Nations, A New Gospel. We're focusing on that today, this hour. You get an episode called Ricardo and Malthus, namely the David Ricardo, the thinker, and the demographer Thomas Malthus, Did You Say Freedom? You get an episode about What If Marx Was Right? And the blurb under that is, have we gotten Marx wrong by focusing on the Communist Manifesto instead of on his critique of how capitalism works, a critique that is relevant and as penetrating as ever? You get an episode on John Maynard Keynes versus Friedrich Hayek, the ideological divide between the two, or at least it's been represented as one, because the subtitle of the episode is A Fake Debate. And finally, the sixth episode is on Karl Polanyi, The Human Factor. It's an exploration of the work of this important thinker. And in fact, his daughter is featured in this film, on this film, as are Dr. Ha-Joon Chang, who teaches at the University of Cambridge. He wrote books like 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. Noam Chomsky, who needs no introduction. David Graeber, who is the author of the acclaimed book Debt, the First 5,000 Years, also considered one of the founders of Occupied Wall Street. He teaches in the UK, as does Professor David Harvey, who is also in this series. He is a radical geographer who teaches at the City University of New York. Michael Hudson is a economics professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thomas Piketty, who is a French economist who made international headlines recently with a book on wealth and income inequality, and Yanis Varoufakis, who was Greece's finance minister last year and is a professor of economic theory at the University of Athens. All of these folks are on this 320-minute, six-part series, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You're giving us a call, Hey KPFA, or you can donate online at kpfa.org, kpfa.org. Every dollar you give is still doubled. We have 15 minutes left to make this match. Let's return now to more of this film series. It's called Capitalism, and this is from episode 2.
People, of course, have different views on whether free market is desirable. So some people believe that we should leave the markets free. Other people say the free markets are not very good. We have to intervene in it to ensure social justice and equity and so on. But most people would actually accept that there is such thing as a free market. You know, I mean, you may or may not like the free market, but you will know it when you see it. But that's the biggest myth about capitalism. Because my question is, what do you actually mean by the free market? And then to illustrate this point, I bring in the example of child labor. Today, in all the rich countries, there's restrictions on child labor. But there was a time when child labor was a very widespread thing. Famous author Daniel Defoe in the 1720s famously praised certain regions of England that were producing textile for being able to offer employment to children from the age of 4 or 5 and allowing them to make a living. In the early 19th century, in the British Parliament, a group of social reformers made the very first attempt to actually officially regulate child labor. Now, even then, a lot of people were against this regulation because they said this regulation is trying to undermine the very foundation of a free market, namely the freedom of contract. So they said that, you know, these children want to work. These people want to employ them. What is your problem? Now, today, a lot of people will find this argument absurd, because people accept that there are certain contracts that society should override, you know, in the interest of general welfare. So the example of child labor beautifully illustrates how markets are essentially a political construct. All markets are propped up by a huge range of regulations. Markets are like that. I mean, once you accept the underlying political values of certain regulations, these regulations become invisible, like those piano wires.
Do we remember slavery? A true free market without those piano wires, where the only considerations were profit and losses. A market which was once widely accepted as the norm.
Smith was very skeptical about whether, in fact, a science of society or a science of economics was actually possible. Smith is always deeply cautious about how free markets should be implemented. The questions which Smith thought were exceedingly difficult to address, about social justice, about fairness, and about maintaining the fabric of society itself, might actually be impossible to address. In the course of history, we have lost all that thinking about the political dimensions, the ethical dimensions of progress towards a full market economy.
How and why, in the process of trying to convert the wealth of nations into reality, were Adam Smith's ethical and political concerns lost? Greed won, and societies were restructured along the logic of the market.
Capitalism. It's called Capitalism. It's a six-part, 5-hour plus documentary series, and the phone number to call to get it for a $20 a month 12-month pledge to KPFA is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We've got our very best phone volunteers here. They're ready to help you, to talk to you, to answer any questions you have. If you want to make a all-at-once $240 pledge to KPFA, you get this series, the six-part series on DVD. If you want to spread it out over monthly installments, they'll tell you how many installments need to be paid before you get it, but it's not very many, I'll tell you that. And it's a $20 a month, 12-month pledge to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge online at kpfa.org. We've gotten another pledge from Glen Ellen. Oh, beautiful Glen Ellen in the North Bay, California. $240 pledge. I would imagine that person is also asking for Capitalism, the six-part series. So you can pledge there as well, because we know we have a lot of listeners who are far and away, but still engaged with KPFA and who still understand the value of KPFA and maybe even this program, Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song, by the way. And I'm delighted to offer you this film series that demystifies capitalism. You heard one of the, it might have been Ha-Joon Chang in this episode, talking about the magical, mystical words that people use when describing capitalism or when conceptualizing capitalism. Of course, invisible hand of the market is an iconic phrase. And you just heard, if you listen to the excerpts this hour, that Adam Smith's understanding of that phrase is very different than how it's been taken to mean. And so we have all these kind of magical, mystical words and phrases, and what this film series does brilliantly, I believe, is to break them down and to demystify them and to make capitalist ideas and anti-capitalist ideas, by the way, accessible. And I say anti-capitalist ideas because there are a bevy of radical thinkers, radical left thinkers, historians, anthropologists, social critics in this film. So the biases of the filmmakers is pretty obvious to me, but you can watch it and you can evaluate it for yourself. And they did strive for a kind of balance as they went through the ideas of people like Adam Smith and David Ricardo and Friedrich Hayek. But of course, Karl Marx is also in here in good measure, as is Karl Polanyi, the radical thinker, as is John Maynard Keynes, the liberal thinker. So there is a very interesting mix of ideas, but there are a lot of radical perspectives in this film series. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. It's a magical number. It's a magic number because we can't do it without people calling. I mean, we really can't do it. There would be no publicity. You're not going to hear Capitalism, a six-part series, featured in the mainstream media on commercial TV or commercial radio, because these outlets, the vast majority of outlets now, because of media consolidation, are in bed with capitalism, are embedded in the capitalist system, have bought into capitalist demands and prerogatives. And therefore, to get a truly, well, to get any kind of critique of capitalism, to get a real understanding of this system that weighs so many people down, that brings us so much inequality, that immiserates so many people while making a very few incredibly rich, we need to have, you might agree, an outlet that presents alternative perspectives, that presents radical ideas, that presents radical politics in a way that is accessible. And again, this six-part series, more than 5 hours of information and insight, beautifully produced. Not one episode, not one film, but six films in one. And sometimes, you know, we offer a single film for a $120 pledge. Well, you get basically six films for a $240 pledge to KPFA. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I'm told we're $610 toward our match of $860, which I said, which I mentioned, which I alerted you to about 10 minutes ago. So that means if we get, oh, maybe one or two more callers before the end of the hour, we'll make this match. But I would love to see people step up in great numbers for KPFA. We're in the third day of KPFA's spring fund drive. And if you like to wait, if you like to hesitate, if you like to hem and haw, there is probably no better value than what I'm offering you this hour. Not in terms of something you buy. You're not buying this film series, Capitalism, for a $20 a month pledge to KPFA at 1-800-439-5732. You're not buying anything. You are giving back. You are giving back in return from what you get. It's a two-way street. This is the only way real public radio, real listener-sponsored, listener-supported radio works. KPFA is stubbornly independent, stubbornly non-commercial. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Give us a call. If you can put up a large gift, you can put up money for a challenge of your own to challenge other listeners to match your contribution in future hours of this fund drive. And, you know, a lot of things have been said about, well, let me say a few more things about this film series, Capitalism, the six-part series. I mean, what the filmmakers, and the filmmaker's name, by the way, is Ilan Ziv, Z-I-V, what he has acknowledges up front is that capitalism has been the engine of unprecedented economic growth and social transformation. But with the fall of many communist states and the triumph of neoliberalism, we have capitalism, by far the world's dominant ideology, but we have a lot of misunderstandings about how it originates, how it originated and what makes it work. So what he decided to do was to put together a history of ideas and a history of social forces and political forces and ecological forces to some degree that have shaped our world, the capitalist world. He put together this film series with on-the-ground footage shot in 22 countries and features dozens of experts and analysts and commentators and thinkers. And he questions in this film, among other things, the myth of the unfettered free market. He explores the nature of debt and commodities, and he retraces some of the great economic debates of the last 200 years. Each 52-minute episode is designed to stand alone. It will be a wonderful thing to watch and then to give to maybe a school, because it is kind of in, you know, these, what do they call these modules, right? 52-minute modules that could be ideal for classroom use or as resources for students. And again, the six episodes are Adam Smith, The Birth of the Free Market, which asserts that capitalism is much more complex than the vision Adam Smith laid out in his famous book, The Wealth of Nations. Episode 2, The Wealth of Nations, A New Gospel, which asserts that Adam Smith's work on morality is largely forgotten. Episode 3, Ricardo and Malthus, goes into global trade agreements, asserts that the roots of today's trade agreements lie in the work of David Ricardo and Thomas Malthus. Episode 4 looks at what if Marx was right. Episode 5 looks at the debate between John Maynard Keynes and Friedrich Hayek, two enormously influential thinkers. And episode 6 looks at the work of Karl Polanyi. So basically, this film series is about making economics accessible by exploring the work of key thinkers while embedding economics in specific social, political, and historical contexts.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.